supermarket.
It was just that one time.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels, plus BBC iPlayer, so you can enjoy the journey of your favourite adventure travel show. It also funds everything you love from the BBC, including Radio 4. Find out more at tvl.co.uk.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 23rd of May. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. The BBC understands that UK officials have suggested to the EU setting up a single market for goods as part of the next phase of the government's Brexit reset. Industry figures briefed on the move say the idea is not currently being taken forward after the EU expressed scepticism and while existing trade talks are going on. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
For weeks, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister have been publicly calling for a much closer economic relationship with the EU in the next phase of post-Brexit talks. There's been little public detail of what that has meant beyond existing talks on single market treatment for the trade in food, farm products, electricity and emissions trading. It's now emerged that UK officials suggested that the agenda for the next summit could be much more ambitious, with one option covering frictionless trade within an EU-UK single market for all goods. The government did not confirm the specifics of any conversations, but acknowledged that a range of options were put to the EU in recent months and conversations are ongoing. British business groups have been briefed on the move, and the EU's pushback that such an ambitious ask would not be negotiable with the government's existing red lines on, for example, freedom of movement.
Cases of the Ebola virus have now been reported across several areas in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which have been affected by conflict. The World Health Organization yesterday raised its risk assessment for Ebola in the country to very high, with the global risk remaining low. Emery Makumeno reports from the capital, Kinshasa.
The authorities say there are now outbreaks in eastern part of the country, including Ituri, North Kivu and South Kivu. No cases have formally been declared in the regional capital, Goma, although there has been one positive laboratory test. So far, more than 700 have been exposed to the virus, with over 170 suspected deaths recorded. The outbreak involves the Budibungio species of Ebola, and the World Health Organization has raised the national risk level to very high.
Elon Musk's company SpaceX has completed a highly anticipated test flight of its redesigned Starship rocket, which NASA hopes to use in future missions to the moon. The new version is the biggest yet. A planned launch on Thursday was postponed because of last-minute technical issues. The spacecraft deployed mock satellites after blasting off from its launch pad in Texas. The test was largely successful and under heightened scrutiny ahead of an expected $1 trillion debut on the US stock market by SpaceX next month. Amber health alerts for hot weather are in place across the Midlands, the east of England and London and the south east, with temperatures expected to reach 30 Celsius today. The warning means there's an increased health risk to people who are vulnerable, including the elderly. The Red Arrows are to fly with fewer aircraft at most displays this year as the RAF looks to preserve the team's ageing fleet. The Hawk T1 jets, which have been used by the aerobatic team since 1980, will still fly in a 9-aircraft formation for the King's birthday flypast next month. One of the most controversial playoff finals in English footballing history will be contested at Wembley this afternoon. Middlesbrough will take on Hull City despite losing to Southampton in the semi-finals. The Saints were expelled from the playoffs for spying on opponents, including Middlesbrough. More details from our sports reporter, Joe Linsky.
In 40 years of playoff finals, there's been no build-up quite like this. Middlesbrough against Hull City will be known as the Spygate match, the fixture that was set to be Hull against Southampton until just 4 days ago. The Saints cannot appeal their expulsion at the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and the club are now the subject of an FA investigation to find out who was responsible for spying. Hull found out their opponents after Tuesday's EFL ruling, and their coach says says they feel like collateral damage. If they lose today, they could launch a legal challenge. So even now, this final may not be Spygate's last act.
Now with the weather, here's Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Very good morning. You've heard about those amber heat health alerts across parts of the Midlands and East England. They're in force and through till Wednesday. But it isn't going to be a story of heat and sunshine everywhere over the coming days. And that is certainly the case today. If we start in the far north and northwest of Scotland, fairly cloudy day in store here. Shetland, some rain at the moment, clearing. Could see a few spots of drizzle in the Western Isles later. Most though will be dry and still a few glimpses of sunshine are possible. To the south and east of Scotland and Northern Ireland, various areas of cloud, but there will be some sunny spells winning through for most areas at times through today. A breeze starting to pick up as we go through into the afternoon. All will stay dry. For northwest England, the Midlands and southwest England, fairly murky and grey start for many at the moment. So we could have some low cloud lingering around the coast of the far southwest and across the Isles of Scilly throughout, but most will lose the cloud. Lots of sunshine developing through the morning. But for the Midlands and eastern half of England, despite the fact there's some spots of rain around at the moment, the odd rumble of thunder too to the east coast, this will clear, sunshine will be out, and highs today in the southeast of 29.
Thanks, Matt. Now for a look at the morning papers. And the Daily Telegraph says Andy Burnham is eyeing a cash raid on the middle class if he becomes Prime Minister, after he told the paper he believed land was undertaxed. The Daily Mail accuses Mr Burnham of planning a tax grab on Middle England after he suggested council tax should be overhauled. But the Financial Times says bond markets have had their best performance in 2.5 years after Mr Burnham said he'd stick to the government's self-imposed borrowing rules if he entered number 10. The former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, tells The Times that out-of-work young people have become trapped by the welfare system and anxiety caused by social media scrolling. Mr Milburn's interim report on the issue, commissioned by the government, is due to be published next week. Hundreds of pounds could be added to the cost of a staycation, according to the Daily Telegraph, as an overnight visitor levy could be imposed in some of England's favourite tourist destinations. The paper says local authority leaders in places such as Whitby and Bamburgh Castle are considering introducing the tax. The government says how the tax will work is yet to be finalised. And that's the news, weather and papers this morning. In half an hour here on Radio 4, how rising costs of strawberries are affecting growers as well as us, and how cuts to tariffs on food imports will hit. Farming Today this week brings us all the detail at 1:30. But now, Claire Balding is back with a new series of Ramblings.
The weather is such an important part of planning for Ramblings, and originally...
Quite a lot of wet ones, haven't you?
Yeah, we sure have, exactly. Originally, we were meant to come to Aberdeenshire in January. It was early January, and those big snowstorms came in, and we had to suspend our plans. But how lucky to get the freshest, brightest spring day to really enjoy the scenery. And I'm joining a group called the Baileys of Benachy, and we're meeting at the Benachy Visitor Centre. It's northwest of Aberdeen, and we are at the base of a great hill to climb. You can see it from miles away. It's called Mither Tap. And Peter, you're going to explain exactly where we're going to go and indeed what you Baileys do.
Well, the Baileys were established in 1973 as a conservation group, and at that time none of this was here, you know, just fairly rudimentary paths. And the Baileys have worked over that 50 years to manage the environment on the hill. We had a bit of a rebranding around our 50th anniversary, and we adopted the slogan, A Voice for the Hill. And for me, that captures everything the Baileys does. You know, I need someone to look after, think about my future, someone to advocate for me, someone to take care of the plants and animals. So a real powerful slogan, certainly for me.
Norwegian fjord. Yeah, yeah. And a little Highland, and a Highland pony. The grey one's a Highland, yeah. Well, we're starting at a very accessible point because there's a big car park, and the visitor centre has got toilets here, it's got tea and coffee, it's got tables outside. Two ladies on ponies who'd been out for a hack just came to say hello. There's a dog walker behind us looking at the at the map. I've seen a runner go by and another one about to set off. So it's a really popular spot. And we're going to do a circular walk of about how long?
7-8 kilometres maybe. Okay. So we'll walk along the flat for about 2 kilometres up the turnpike heading north, which is fairly flat. Then we'll turn south again and head up to the top of Mither Tap.
If you'd like to follow us on the map, the grid reference for the Benahi Visitor Centre is NJ698216. By the way, do look at our Instagram page, which is at BBC Ramblings, mainly to see how well the Baileys treated us before we've even set off. And I have to say credit to Stella and Anne, who provided snacks and coffee and all sorts. So we've been well entertained before we even start. And Stella, you got in touch with us because you wanted to share this place and these people.
Yeah, it's such an incredible group of people who volunteer to help do the work on the hill and come up with great ideas for improving for everybody.
And have you lived in this area your whole life, Stella, or have you come here?
I've been born and brought up in Moneymusk. I moved away to England for 15 years or so and came back up. I now live in Kemney, and I'm very lucky to have a picture window to look onto Benahi, even though I'm in the middle of the village.
And it really does, it does stand out, doesn't it? It's a conical shaped hill.
Yeah.
And the top of it is bare. I mean, almost, and grey in colour.
Yeah. And there's a fort. So when you go up there, you'll see the hill fort. And they can talk about that then. But it's just that feeling of home for me. It's just part of the place where I belong.
And Mither Tap translates as Mother's Tap?
Yeah, the mother, the biggest hill. There's actually 7 peaks. And although it's the most prominent, it's not actually the tallest. I think it's Craigshiner meets it by 10 metres. But it's the most iconic. Yeah. It's the mother of the hills.
We've made a short climb up onto a lovely wide path with a moss and lichen covered dry stone wall to the right hand side, a ditch for drainage on the left, trees beyond it, and the temperature cooler here because we're not in the full sunlight, but the surface really good to walk on. Oh, listen, what have we got there, Lorna?
Well, that's a chiffchaff, one of the migrants coming in for the spring. But yeah, very distinctive. Chiffchaff, chiffchaff.
And tell me a bit more about the wildlife that we might find around here.
We've had a project recently putting up trail cameras. Uh-huh. So we've seen some roedeer fawns. We were lucky enough, and right in front of one of the cameras we had the fawn and its mother stopped and the fawn suckled. And then we've seen red deer, which is a wee bit more surprising. Quite a small herd, actually, we think. Again, breeding. Pine marten, that's an animal now that's, or a mammal now that's becoming a bit more popular. Wildcat would have been a lovely thing to got on camera. Not to say they're not here, but unlikely.
The view has opened up to the right, and we've got that rich farmland. You can see the soil. Mm-hmm. You know that is good soil. Yeah. It's so deep in its brown, reddish-brown colour. Yeah. The left-hand verge is glowing yellow because the flowers are out on the gorse. How are you doing, Stella?
I'm fine, thank you. Yeah. On the flat, I'm all good. When I heard you speak about the gorse up here, they would be whins or firs, because we've got the local dialect, the Doric language. When you were speaking about the dry stone dike, my father used to say, when you're building a dike, twa stones together, Ina bin twa, pack wheel and foon wheel, and you'll big a guidwa. So it's just 2 stones side by side, one on top of the 2. Pack wheel, so make sure there's no gaps. Foon wheel is foundations, and you'll end up with a good wall.
Oh. Path has got a little more rocky, loose stones on top of it, and narrower as well, but still very easy to walk 2 or 3 abreast. And what's your role within the Baileys, Alan?
Well, I'm a trustee with the Baileys, and my responsibility is to tell the story of the archaeology, the historical landscape in the hill. I grew up about 17 miles away in a farm, and the hill was always in my eye line. And although I never climbed it much when I was younger, it's always been there. Saw the opportunity back in 2018 to do some volunteering on a dig, and I just kind of fell in love with the whole thing. Just wanted to get involved and find where I am now. So this is a fog house. This is a 19th century structure that the ladies that were maybe living or staying at Pittodrie House, which is just a mile up the road there, would have came for tea and maybe even a smoke. We can probably get in here, actually. Fancy a wee scramble?
If we're allowed.
Oh, God.
Listen, if you say we can, then we can.
Well, it's near our land, but I'm sure we can dive in.
Well, I certainly can look out over there.
But at your own risk, I have to say. Peter's missed a risk assessment, so at your own risk. So we'll scramble down here.
Yep.
We'll use this as an unofficial guide rail. I'll go first. Then you can come in and see it.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, the waterfall's amazing. So I'll go first.
I might turn myself around.
I did that a few times.
Yeah. We've scrambled down to get into the space, which has the feeling, and particularly the shape of that window with its sort of peaked top, has the feeling of a little chapel.
It does a little bit, but there's no indication of anything to do with a chapel.
Okay.
But the view to the waterfall is absolutely stunning. We had an archaeological dig just down there, and there was always a story in the press back in the, I think it was in the early 20th century, that vandals had came and pushed in the walls or pushed in the windows. And the guys were just poking about down in the hoch down there, and they suddenly came across this piece of iron. And it was actually the iron frame of the windows. Sort of one of the windows, probably this window. So one of the projects we hope to do is to try and use that as a template to try and put it back in place, use it as a little bit of protection for kids and dogs and so on, try and recreate what it may have looked like back in the day.
Just looking through the trees and across that field, is that Pittodrie House?
It is, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So quite a stern looking big square grey house, but with turreted wall down the left.
Yeah.
I see the right-hand side of it, which I hadn't quite clocked. Is that red brick and more Victorian style, that fairy tale castle?
There is that, the building certainly goes back to certainly 1640s, certainly for sure, but then bits would have been added on over the course of the centuries.
And up to a few years ago, they actually owned all this land.
Mm-hmm. Whose was it originally, Pittodrie House?
Been owned by a laird.
The Erskine family.
Is it?
Yeah, the Erskine family is the traditional owners, I believe,
We've been climbing steadily upwards. We're going to make our way round the edge of Mither Tap, but we've dived off left because they said, you must come and see the curling pond. The curling pond has in the sport of curling. And I think that's what it is. And it is a beautifully circular, perfect pond, surrounded by trees and heather and moss and the soft needles under our feet. So this is actually a curling pond.
Yes, man-made curling pond. There's a dam along here you can kind of see the remnants of. Square, only about a foot deep, maybe 2 foot deep.
So it would freeze easily.
It freeze easily, that's right. And of course, our winters were much colder back then.
So when would this have been designed?
Very contemporary with the Victorian phase of Pittodrie House. It would have been attached to Pittodrie House.
You can imagine them hiking up here. It wouldn't take them too long, maybe half an hour, if that.
Well, send the man on ahead with the stones.
Yes, or keep the stones up here, which would have been more sensible.
Maybe, yeah.
They're heavy.
Yeah. It would have been contemporary with the fog house as well, at the same time, so around about the same time period. But the joy you get now is probably less so curling, but people coming up here with their dogs absolutely love this spot. Nice spot for a picnic. It's beautiful.
We are gaining height rapidly, and out of the protection of the tree is now exposed to the wind, which is a cooling breeze. And Peter, we're walking on a lovely wide path that has these massive rock slabs that cover the whole thing, so you're sort of, it's a natural pathway up the side of the hill. What's this called?
This is called the Maiden's Causeway, and our folklore suggests that the devil was trying to proposition a young lady, to which he said, well, if you can build a path to the top of Mither Tap in a day, then you're on. And the devil did. And we're coming to another point called Hosey's Well. Hosey was a foot soldier, you would say, at the Battle of Harlaw, 1411, which was fought just over the other side of the hill here. And he was engaged to a young lady, but unfortunately he was captured. And of course back then, there was no reporting as to whether you're captured or whether you're killed. And months turned into years. But it turned out he had been captured. Came home and found that his fiancée had married somebody else. So it suggests that he laid down up here and let his life slip away. And Hosey's Well reflects the tears he shed. Our other big folklore is there's meant to be a giant on the hill called Jock of Benhee. And he didn't get on with the one at Tappanoth, which is about 10, 12 miles to the east of us. And they would notionally be throwing rocks back at each other. And often you'll find a large stone left by a glacier called an erratic. And the story would be that this is some of the stones that had been thrown that missed and kept going.
So, Peter, you were telling me about Hosey's Spring, and there's a whole information board here. You didn't tell me this. Jean dropped dead. Jean, the original love. So she died as well.
Yeah, give me a break.
It's a good story,
yeah,
though.
It is a good story.
Hosey's tears running eternally down the mountainside. Yeah. It's basically just a spring, though.
It is a spring, yes. I don't think Mr. Hosey is anywhere to be seen. Yeah. Not anymore.
I like the story, though.
Yeah.
So it looks like the route right to the top is just rocks and scree, but there's actually a channel through, is there?
This is the entrance to the hill fort here. So this rubble here would have been the original walls that protected the hill fort. We reckon they were about 5 metres high. And this entranceway is the entranceway to the citadel. And this would have been a Pictish hill fort. So again, we believe it was occupied around about 600 to 800 AD.
Gosh.
You can imagine the Picts looking across this landscape. You would have had Roman marching camps in Kintore, a Roman marching camp in Logidurno, just down the hills there. So they could have been up here looking down on these Roman armies marching north.
Saying good luck to you.
Come and catch us if you can up here. So I can only imagine the effort would have gone into constructing walls, you know, of this size, this much stone.
But also when you've got no cranes, you've got mechanical help getting it up.
Yep.
You've got probably sturdy little ponies like that Highland pony we saw early on.
Yep.
That wind is picking up and it's chasing across a dark-looking cloud. You two went to... How was it up there?
Extremely windy.
Where have you travelled from?
Well, we live in Aberdeen, but I'm from Slovenia.
I'm from Peru.
It's the first time that we came up here, so...
Oh, good. Oh, great to see you. Oh, hello. Hey.
You've got a nice day for this.
Did you just run the whole way up?
Well, I walked quickly. Didn't run.
Hello, Heidi. There's a good girl. She's sweet, isn't she? She's a bearded collie. They're really pretty.
It's a bunny dog.
That lovely couple that we met earlier have obviously had a great day. And just as they were coming down, there's a man that's gone by with a bearded collie called Heidi. She is leading him up to the top. And he is running up those steps right to the summit. And Lorna, do people race up here?
Yes, there is hill races. Yeah, there's many on the Benhee, the whole range of Benhee. Sometimes, so there is in the summer. But we also had a big event in 2019 where we hugged Benhee. And we called it the Benhee Bosie. B-O-S-I-E, and Bosey being Scots for a hug. We worked it out. We needed about 400 people to go around the summit here holding hands, or if we didn't have enough, we had jumpers that were holding out, so we had the end of jumpers. So we had about 400 people all around the hill. We had the pipe band at the top. Found it a bit tough, I think, to play the bagpipes at the top. The sort of the air was a bit thinner, so they were sort of piping, you know, they didn't feel they got the right tone. But anyway, we thought it was great, so we did a bit of fundraising for breast cancer, because obviously Mither Tap is very similar, the sort of contour of it is very similar to a breast, so it's Mither Pap, so to speak. So the Breast Cancer University Development Trust and also the Aberdeen Mountain Rescue.
What a great event.
So we did, so it was great.
Yeah.
We had the weather like we've had today, so we were so, so lucky.
Would you like to punch through up to the top? Well done. Well done, Peter.
We've clambered right up to the top now. And coming up the big stone steps, you then are hit by even stronger wind. And right at the top, there is a disc with not just the directions, and I'm facing due west at the moment, but also the names of all the hills and the villages. So we can see Loch Na Garr to the south west of us, covered in snow. And you follow the direction of the line, and you can see Knock Hill, which is up to the north of us, and some lovely old names. There's a Hill of Cat. And Anne, this was tied to your family, this disc getting up here.
The original Baileys. Got the local school involved, the Inverurie Academy, the technical department, and then they had to carry it up barehanded all the way to the top to install it. So that was quite an event. There's lots of photographs of tired looking people and a lot of feckless youths that were involved in it as well. So it was a good project.
And your father was one of them?
He was a teacher there, yeah. A lot of teachers were involved in the Baileys.
And the only thing wrong with it is that in the centre there's an inscription saying designed and erected by the Baileys of Benachie. I thought Benachie had two N's, and there's only one that in there. But there we are.
Technical department.
Absolutely.
It wasn't the English department.
Yeah, it wasn't. Clearly wasn't the English department. No.
Super careful on the way down. Need to go on your bum a bit.
Okay. As so often happens, the descent is so much harder than getting up the top, and a lot of it was scrambling down. In fact, the very beginning of it, actually on my bottom, much more relaxed now because we're back down on an easy path. Alan, you better talk me through this, because we've got the base of a cottage that's really clear in its rectangular shape.
Yeah, this is Shepherd's Lodge. This is part of the Benachie Colony. The Benachie Colony was formed of the poorest society that squatted in this piece of land, for better words, that they were able to not pay rent, they could build cottages, eke out a living, maybe doing some diking, working as shepherds, growing their own food. And we've recreated here as well a kale yard using traditional methods of cultivation and fertilisation. Got great crops, red currants, black currants, raspberries. And we've got a volunteer rota of people that come and weed it and keep it nice and prune it. There were probably three generations of people lived here. There would have been a living accommodation again, accommodation for the animals. And this house was lived in by Alexander Littlejohn and his family. And my rota month was September. And it was a beautiful night, you know, it was so still, so quiet. There was a little bit of wind. And I sat inside there and I tried to put myself in the mind of Alexander Littlejohn. He can out a living the best he could, but he had his family, he had all the people he loved around him. And I thought, I'm going to write myself a poem. I've never written a poem since I was like 8 or whatever. And I thought, I'm going to write a poem and try and put myself in the mind of Alex Littlejohn. The amazing thing was that three years later, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Alexander Littlejohn, who lives in Ohio, had traced her family tree. And she wanted to come across and see where her ancestors had lived and worked. And I was able to read that poem to her through the eyes of our ancestors. And it was such an emotional moment. And she's now got that poem embroidered and up on her wall in Ohio.
Oh, wow.
So it was an amazing thing.
Can I hear it?
You can, yeah. Okay. I've got nothing. But we've got a thing. The seeds in the bream are rattling, and the wind's fairly bland, but it keeps the midges away. My loon caught twa trout today, wi' a tatty and a bit of rhubarb, a rare treat I have to say. I'll maybe hear a wee nip for Jockey Stell roon the hill. It's Guy Rochkine, oor muckle, and I'll be ill. The youngians are playing doon the how, nae care to be had. If we ever have to leave here, then I surely will be sad. I've got nothing, but we've got a-thing. And then sadly, in 1858, I think it was, Alexander Littlejohn was evicted when the commonty was divided to the different landowners. He was forced to pay rent, couldn't afford it. And the story goes that the walls of his cottage were pushed in and he was forcibly evicted. So a sad story, but the story of his ancestors coming to visit is something that will live with me forever.
It's clouded over now. The temperature has dropped somewhat, but we've made it back to the car park. And Stella has laid out a table for us. There's grapes in a bowl, and there's tangerines and kiwis and apples and a little vase of flowers. Well, this is top-notch, can I say? I've really enjoyed meeting you all. Loved that walk. Glad that you said to me, get up there, you've got to get right to the top. Mm-hmm. See the view. The top of Mither Tap. But yeah, good luck with all the projects still to come.
Thanks very much.
And keep being the voice of the hills.
Yeah. Perfect.
Thank you
very much indeed.
Thanks for visiting.
Pleasure. Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Greger. Farming Matters takes centre stage next here on Radio 4, but first let's look ahead to the coming week.
So we have a statue here. Who's this?
That is Henry Ford himself.
Back in the 1920s, Ford's factories popularised the working week. But a century on, how has it shaped our economy, our culture, and how we think?
It stands for not just artificial timekeeping, but all of the ways in which social organisation produces time.
Across my own Monday to Friday, I'll examine its impact and its future.
We have AI replacing jobs faster than ever before.
TikTok, the working week in 5 days. With me, Phil Tinline, this Monday to Friday lunch break at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Anna Hill.
Good morning. Flower power robotics.
The two machines can plant about 23,000 bulbs an hour. We're doing now the same operation that we would have been doing last year with 14 people, with three or four people.
Warnings about the impact of climate change.
There are things we can do to help to protect the UK farming sector and food prices from those risks, but we need action now from government.
But there's welcome news on a new trade deal.
High-end products, big demand in the Middle East, an enormous opportunity for the UK to expand all of that with a lot less tariffs. This is really good.
We'll have more on that later. Let's start with a big bouquet of flowers. All week we've been celebrating British blooms. The cut flower market in the UK is worth around £2.2 billion, but most of the stems sold in supermarkets and florists don't come from British farms. But there is a growing network of producers trying to change that. Kate Fox is one of them. She set up the South Yorkshire Flower Hub, bringing local growers and florists together to create an online wholesale market of seasonal British-grown flowers. Mary Ward-Lowry has been to Gringley on the Hill in Nottinghamshire to find out more.
Got a bit of all sorts. Got some larkspur coming, some sweet peas, some butterfly ranunculus. So I've been flower farming for about 5 years. I thought, how can you make it easier for smaller growers to get involved? So I thought, why don't we all load up our flowers into one central website, and then the florist can shop from that as though it was a wholesale website.
And these are all local flowers, these are all British grown flowers.
Yeah, every one of the growers that are on our South Yorkshire Flower Hub are grown without pesticides, without herbicides.
The growers bring the flowers they've sold on Kate's app to a central location where the florists then pick them up.
It's been going really well. It was really satisfying to get a really big order from a florist that had never done a British wedding before, and we managed to service it and we delivered. So four growers contributed to that one wedding.
And how many flowers was that?
It was an absolute van full, but I would say in excess of 700 stems.
Since March, Kate signed up 37 florists and 22 growers. It also makes British flowers more accessible to local florists who might never have worked with them before. So it's about sustainability too.
I think we'll start to increasingly question the legitimacy of importing flowers from the other side of the world. And I know there's the argument that in Africa or Colombia or these kind of places that flowers are a profitable crop and you're contributing to that economy. There's a lot of damage from water usage, probably not the same standards and specifications around pesticide usage that we would have in this country. How do I make this better? Just choose local flowers, choose seasonal flowers, low carbon, no pesticides, low impact, and that's just got to be better, hasn't it?
Kate Fox there from Fox Farm Flowers. Well, there are big flower producers too. In Norfolk, Collinson Cut Flowers near King's Lynn grows 35 million tulips every year, supplying most of the UK's leading supermarkets. With fierce competition, particularly from Holland, it's invested £5 million in new technology to stay in the game. Bob Hockenhull visited one of its glasshouses with director Ian Collinson.
So this is what we call our tulip forcing house. So we're trying to recreate the perfect spring day. So we're heating the glasshouse to 16.5 degrees. In here, we've invested heavily in automation. The tulips are all grown hydroponically in plastic trays. So all the operations that we were doing by hand is now all being done by machinery, by automation and robotics.
And why did you decide to do that?
Cost of labour is increasing relentlessly in the UK. Our competition on tulips really comes from Holland, where they also have a relatively high wage structure, but they're very highly automated. So if we weren't, we would be uncompetitive.
We've got some robots here handling the bulbs.
The bulbs are singulated onto the conveyor belt in the middle of the machine. We then take six images of every bulb. We can then put that through a piece of AI software. If the bulb is diseased, the robots won't pick it up. If it's not diseased, then the robots will pick it up, place it into the tray with the roots facing down towards the water and the sprout facing up towards the sky. The two machines can plant about 23,000 bulbs an hour. We're doing now the same operation that we would have been doing last year with 14 people, with three or four people.
Total workforce was 100 before automation. Now it's down to 70. Krasi Chavdarov worked here before the technology was installed and now works alongside it.
Now everything is getting easier for us to do it and faster. Also with the technologies, we are improving the quality of the bunches.
Are you worried that even more technology might come and that there'll be less need for human beings?
In some point, yes, that will happen, definitely. Not in next 5 years, but in maybe 50 years' time that will happen. But we can't change nothing.
Collinson Cut Flowers is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year and has had to change with the times. Ian Collinson again.
Certain parts of the business are definitely recognisable as to how Mum and Dad would have been doing things back then, you know, planting, you know, the scented stocks that we plant in the soil, whereas something like tulips at that time would have been completely unrecognisable. You know, hydroponic tulips weren't around then, so tulips would have been produced maybe in crates, but they would have then been planted in soil with, you know, sand on top. A lot of very, very heavy manual labour, lots of disease risk, a very, very long growing period, and that's completely changed around now. We're in a very efficient, very clean, yeah, fast hydroponic system, which has completely revolutionised tulip production around the world.
Ian Collinson ending that report from Bob Hockenhull. And this week's Rare Earth takes a deeper dive into all things floral, exploring how flowers have evolved to attract pollinators and how they can help restore lost landscapes. You can hear more from botanists and pollen experts by searching for Rare Earth on BBC Sounds. Well, like the generational change at Collinson's, the Duchy of Cornwall is also facing some fundamental rethinking. A fifth of the duchy's property, owned by the Prince of Wales, could be sold in the next 10 years to help invest £500 million into tackling housing and nature crises. The duchy has a large number of tenant farmers and is introducing a new tenancy agreement, which concentrates on regenerative farming. The first one's a 25-year tenancy on a 900-acre farm in Herefordshire. Kaz Graham spoke to Matthew Morris, Executive Director for Rural at the Duchy of Cornwall.
So we want to create a framework that allows our tenants to go on the regenerative journey, but in a way that's supported. So they're going to have technical guidance, support from our team, but most of all, they've got that long-term security to make the transition.
How does the Duchy define regenerative?
So we follow the principles of regenerative agriculture, so maintaining soil health, maintaining cover in the winter. Across the Duchy, we've got farms in the lowlands, we've got farms up on Dartmoor, and of course out on the Isles of Scilly as well. So each of those farms will have a slightly different way of approaching regenerative. There's no right or wrong answer.
It's not an easy time to be starting out with something like that. Politically, farmers have no certainty about where they're going to be in the future. In terms of funding, everything is up in the air at the moment. What kind of support are you going to give? Are you going to give financial support to those tenants?
Well, first and foremost, the biggest support we can give is a long-term lease, which enables them to plan ahead and to go through the transition to regen. So in that journey, we're going to be working with funders, verification standards. But most of all, with our Farming and Nature team, we are going to be there alongside them for the journey. So much more collaborative. We've got a number of focus farms as well. So we've got farms across the Duchy that we're working super closely with. They're able to sort of show their fellow farmers what they've been doing, and they can talk to the successes and also the failures. And I think that's really important.
You have many farms across the Duchy, and this is just part of a kind of transformation of what you're doing within the Duchy estate, which has included some pretty tough decisions, actually, hasn't it? I mean, for example, recently you've decided to sell off farms and property in the village of Bradninch in Devon, which has faced really severe local criticism. Why did you do that specifically?
Yeah, so the Duchy's always been on a journey of buying and selling farms. We have a large portfolio, and that's something that the Duchy's always done. What we want to do is just make sure that we are equipped for the future, and we want to make sure that we're able to deliver brilliantly for our communities and for nature. So the portfolio is undergoing a bit of a rebalancing exercise. But our regen journey, really, on our retained estate is something that we're really diving into. We think that's going to take some time. We're not doing every tenant at once, but we're looking forward to supporting all of our farmers on that journey.
When you say we're not doing every farm at once, does that imply that all Duchy farms will be farming regeneratively in the future?
Ultimately, that is our ambition. So as we have tenancy renewals, as we have new lettings, we'll be using our new RFBT as a template to help that journey.
What if one of your existing farmers does not want to make that change?
Well, ultimately, tenants have freedom of choice. I mean, that's a central part of any landlord and tenant relationship. What I hope, though, is that they see the change. They see their fellow farmers and what they're doing. And in these dry summers we've had recently, looking over the fence and seeing a lush green field when yours is burnt off. It's those sorts of things that are going to drive change.
Matthew Morris from the Duchy of Cornwall. Well, the Duchy's focus on regenerative farming comes just as the Climate Change Committee this week published some dire warnings about the possible consequences of a 2% rise in global temperatures and what the UK needs to do about it. The report by the CCC, which advises UK governments on adapting to climate change, highlights risks from extreme heat, drought and flooding, and says that by 2050, 92% of homes are likely to overheat and water supply shortfalls could exceed 5 billion litres a day. Responding to the report, the government said it had already invested a record £2.65 billion in flood defences and had deployed the largest nature-friendly farming budget in history to support sustainable food production. Emma Pinchbeck is CEO of the Climate Change Committee.
As always, when you're thinking about climate change, farmers are the providers of solutions, thinking about approaches to the landscape that help reduce the risks of flooding and investing in nature restoration, but also thinking about what we need to do to keep farming viable in itself. So how can we change how we think about, for example, water storage on farms to help a community response to a drought or multiple farms responding to a drought rather than an individual farm, changing the sorts of crops that we grow to build a more resilient natural landscape, but also to keep food production at today's levels.
DEFRA might say that many of the things you've mentioned are already included in its environmental schemes. Are you saying that the government needs to give farmers more help to do this?
We are absolutely saying that farmers need more help from the government, and that's in a number of ways. If you look at things like subsidies or support for farmers, we don't think that those are properly targeted at the world as it is and will be. They should support nature resilience, but also there's regulation and planning that actively harm farmers being able to have an adaptive response. Farmers, for example, cannot currently share water storage between farms. We are definitely saying that DEFRA needs to do more for the farming community to keep farming viable.
What about food security? What risks do we face around that?
In most cases, there are actions that farmers can take to help reduce their exposure to those risks. And that includes things like planting different kinds of crop, more mixed farming, being able to store water, thinking about shading alongside having livestock so that there is less exposure to heat for livestock and therefore a reduction in yield on things like milk. So there are really practical things that farmers will be able to do. Beyond that, there are also risks from things like extreme heat abroad affecting commodities, and we've seen prices for things like olive oil already going up in response to wildfires in Europe, and other imported risks to farming like increased diseases or different kinds of diseases. Again, there are things we can do to help to protect the UK farming sector and food prices from those risks, but we need action now from government and from major food retailers and businesses that look after those international food supply chains.
Emma Pinchbeck, CEO of the Climate Change Committee. Well, it seems pressure on farming is coming from many angles at the moment, as the cost of growing our food is still higher than before the conflict in the Middle East. To counteract some of that, earlier this week, the government laid out a Great British Savings Bonanza aimed at making life a little less expensive for everyone. And as part of that, there'll be cuts to tariffs on more than 100 food imports sold in supermarkets to help reduce pressure on food prices. We don't know which products yet. The government's also going to reduce fuel duty on red diesel used by farmers by a third. We'll get the NFU's thoughts on that shortly. But our reporter Theo White has been to a fruit farm in Kent to find out how they're faring with rising costs. Hugh Lowe Farms grows strawberries, blackberries and raspberries. Marion Reagan, the managing director, met Theo in a polytunnel full of strawberry plants.
What you can see here are that we've got
Gales just blowing.
I know.
Lucky we're undercover here.
That's why you can see we're in a tunnel. So what you can see is a plant with a number of open flowers, some ripening fruit, and some red fruit further up the row.
So picking started elsewhere, I understand, but not here yet.
We start under glass, and then we quite quickly move into these unheated polytunnels.
So speaking of glasshouses, they're obviously quite an expensive thing to heat at the best of times. Is this somewhere you've seen the energy costs affect your profit margins?
We're quite fortunate in that we had sort of hedged our energy costs in our glass, and we don't try and go particularly early, so we're not putting a lot of heat into glass. With the rising cost of energy, I think it has challenged some glasshouse growers quite severely. Now it's the effect of energy costs on other inputs. So the big costs that we are looking at, it's the growing costs, the fertiliser, and of the people who we value who harvest the crop.
So once you've grown it, you've got to get it to your customers.
Yes.
You've got big customers all over the country. Obviously, logistics become a big thing here. So talk to me about fuel price, and is that something you've been feeling?
Well, yes, fuel price affecting haulage costs and also fuel price affecting packaging. There are things that one can do to make sure that orders are smoothly fulfilled, that you're going to the closest depot. You know, there's lots of work in that logistic piece which can take cost out of the chain. British growers are amongst the most innovative, most efficient in the world.
To be honest, you don't sound too pessimistic, so I'll be interested to know your answer to this. But how do you think things are going to go this summer for British berry growers. Are you worried?
I think it's a storm that can be weathered, and I also am eternally optimistic because I am a British berry grower and it's May. And actually, I think the crop looks really good and everything we've picked so far has been delicious.
I'm interested to know whether or not you think the government should be stepping in times like these where energy costs have unexpectedly risen for British farmers.
I think that the specialist glasshouse growers have a good case to make when other sectors have made that case successfully to government. Taken in the round, I think British fruit growing, like British farming, needs the support of the government in terms of a good environment for doing business, for being able to have the confidence to invest in these crops because it's a substantial capital investment. And I think that between growers, government, but also customers, we can create a resilient and healthy sector, soft fruit.
Marion Reagan there. A DEFRA spokesperson told us fruit and vegetable growers are central to our growth mission and horticulture will be a priority sector under the new Farming and Food Partnership Board. They said the government had given a record £11.8 billion in funding over this parliament and extended the seasonal worker visa scheme while slashing costs and red tape for producers to export to the EU. Well, exports further afield than the EU were in the spotlight as a new trade deal was announced with a group of six states in the Gulf, including Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. It'll remove export tariffs and open the door to market expansion, although concerns have been raised about the human rights records of some of those Gulf states. Chris Southworth is Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce, UK. He spoke to Kaz Graham.
You know, we're talking about very practical things. This is good for the regions, good for the north, particularly Scotland. Think salmon, think whiskey. The rest of the UK, think chocolate, you know, cheese, biscuits, tea, halal beef, all of which are high-end products, big demand in the Middle East, an enormous opportunity for the UK to expand all of that with a lot less tariffs. This is a 93% reduction in tariffs. This is really good for trade liberalisation.
And how significant is this deal compared to, say, some of the other deals that we've already seen, things like the trade agreements with South Korea and India?
I think it's really important in the context of a major emerging region, you know, more or less on par with the likes of South Korea, above what we were negotiating with the likes of Australia and New Zealand a few years ago. Should be good news for the farming sector and production sector in the UK. And it's coming at a really good time where things are very challenging. As we all know, we can see the news. This is exactly the kind of direction that we need to see the UK going in.
Where does it sit alongside the Chancellor's announcement yesterday that she's cutting import tariffs on some foodstuffs? I mean, we don't know what the full list of products is yet, but if some imports are going to be cheaper in the shops here, what effect will that have on UK farmers?
There has to be a fine balance struck here. But this is also about reducing the cost of living. So the Chancellor's in a difficult place where she has to balance what comes in, what goes out. But actually, we're, I think, 40% food reliant on other countries. So we don't produce enough food for our own population. We rely on imports. That's a really important part of our food security. We rely on other countries supporting exports in terms of generating growth, but also allowing more imports coming in with fewer duties that allow us or our producers, manufacturers, to have less input costs in order to get those costs on the shelves reduced for the consumer. It's really important.
Chris Southworth from the ICC. And as he was saying, that trade deal with those Gulf states should offer new opportunities for British food and farming. So alongside the cut in fuel duty on red diesel, it looks as though farmers might just be happy with the government for once. Kaz spoke to NFU President Tom Bradshaw from the Devon County Show.
First of all, the trade deal with the Gulf states is one where there's great opportunity for our British food that has such a high reputation, and for them to safeguard our sensitive sectors within that trade deal while opening up access to the Gulf states is something that we really welcome, and we respect the way they've negotiated that trade deal. And then on the red diesel duty, look, we know how much we've seen red diesel prices rise since the start of this conflict. Our members are highly exposed to this, so the recognition from government of how severe it is and also the action in reducing that fuel duty is something that's very welcome across the farming industry.
Well, what do you make of these reduced tariffs on some food imports announced by the Chancellor?
Well, look, clearly, if those tariff reductions are on food that we produce here, then that's something that's going to be incredibly concerning for those members that are producing those goods. So we await the detailed list with real interest.
I mean, the government says that the list of products that are involved will be announced next week, and that it does take account of domestic production and food security, and says it doesn't include any significant UK primary agricultural production. Are you confident that that will be okay? Are you happy with that statement?
That we've been working very hard with the government to try and make sure they understand exactly what we do produce and where we would be most worried about those tariff reductions. But more long term, every time we have a global shock, we can't have a knee-jerk reaction that says, how can we make it cheaper from somewhere else? We should be asking the question, how do we create the investment in UK food production that builds the resilience? We've got that production here and we're less impacted.
You're at the Devon County Show. Do you think people are feeling a little more positive?
There's a real nervousness in the farming industry. They can see all of the challenges with fertiliser prices, energy costs, milk prices collapsing. But I think what these signals start to show is a government which, particularly with the red diesel, is in tune with the challenge. But we will be watching very, very closely about those the reduction in tariffs, because we understand the cost of living crisis, but there's a cost of farming crisis as well. And everybody in this country needs a resilient food system, and profitable, thriving farming businesses is the only way we can deliver the resilience in that food system for the long term.
President of the NFU, Tom Bradshaw. We are trying to stay positive on this programme this bank holiday weekend. Now, you may remember a few months ago, we featured this. Choir of farmers who reached the semi-finals of ITV's Britain's Got Talent. Arable farmer Ben Brook described the moment they got the golden buzzer from judge Amanda Holden.
And obviously she pressed the golden buzzer, and I looked round, all the choir were just like jumping around, and I was just like, we don't even know we've got through yet. And then looked down, it was all gold, and I was just like, woo! Amazing. It's like being in like a family you didn't know you had. It's like, yeah, it's just amazing. Like, farming can be like super isolating, and you're in your own thoughts a lot. So if we can raise awareness for mental health within agriculture, that's something that we really want to push.
Ben Brook from Cambridgeshire, a member of the Hawkstone Choir, who are singing again in Britain's Got Talent tonight. So all the best to them. That's all from us today. I'm Anna Hill. The producer is Rebecca Rooney. Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
This is BBC Radio 4, where now Matt Taylor's back with that all-important weather, Matt.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Very good morning, all. Well, a spell of exceptional heat this coming week, not just for the weekend, but all the way through next week across much of England and Wales, just with a brief dip expected as we go through into Thursday. Scotland, Northern Ireland, you're going to see the temperatures with you peak probably around Wednesday or Thursday. A lot more cloud here over the next few days. We could actually see a little bit of rain at times as well, but overall, it's a predominantly dry picture. And just to put this hot spell into a little bit of context, in the last 126 years, we've only had around 10-ish days in which temperatures have got to 30 degrees or more in May in the UK. Over the coming days, we could see another 4 or 5 added to that tally. We'll also see the earliest May 30 degree temperature recorded, and also potentially the May record for both day and nighttime heat could also fall by the time we get to Bank Holiday Monday too. Certainly a warm start out there across parts of England and Wales. We're going to start in the Midlands and eastern England. Some of these areas, of course, under amber heat health alert all the way through till Wednesday. We have had some thunderstorms this morning along North Sea coast, and still a bit of rain at the moment across parts of East Anglia and just to the north of London. That will clear in the next couple of hours, and then it's sunshine for the rest of the day. The cloud breaking up, and it should be blue skies for the vast majority. For northwest England, Wales and the southwest of England, as well as the Isle of Man, and there is some areas of low cloud around at the moment, a bit grey, misty in a few spots, especially the further southwest you are. And around some coasts of Devon, Cornwall and also the Isles of Scilly, there could be a few areas of low cloud still lapping on shore every now and again. Most places, though, will turn brighter and sunnier in the coming hours. For Northern Ireland, South and East Scotland, varying amounts of cloud. Some good sunny spells coming through throughout today, though. But to the north and northwest of Scotland, a lot more cloud here. Rain at the moment in Shetland clearing. Could see a few spots middle part of the day in the Western Isles. Most, though, will be dry. 12 to 17 in the north of Scotland. Most around 17 to 22. But across the Midlands, East Anglia, the South East, 24 to 29.
Thanks, Matt. It seems Paris is where the party's at the moment. The Hay Festival is in full swing in Hay-on-Wye. Anna Foster is there for the Today programme next, with Katia Adler holding the fort in London. Then at 9, Adrian Childs gatecrashes the shindig, with Saturday Live taking the opportunity to catch up at the festival with a literary polymath and Paddington dad, Hugh Bonneville. But before all that, a look to next weekend.
It's just the wildest story. But it actually happened.
On BBC iPlayer.
Believe in Magic was like no other charity.
The sweeter the story,
they would just appear and sprinkle their magic.
The darker the truth.
It was all based on a lie.
It was unbelievable.
A mother and daughter running this charity. Was Meghan really sick?
The story doesn't add up.
The mother of all cons.
I had no idea where it would all lead.
Starts next Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
On FM, on digital radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 23rd of May. This is Today with Anna Foster at Hay Festival and Katia Adler in London.
The headlines this morning. The BBC understands that the government has pitched to Brussels setting up a single market for goods as part of a post-Brexit reset. The Democratic Republic of Congo says cases of the Ebola virus are now being reported in more parts of the country's war-torn east.
And we are live this morning in front of an audience here at Hay Festival in the town of Hay-on-Wye. You are in good voice so early in the morning. We're right on the border of England and Wales this morning. We will be speaking to big names in art, literature, science and politics throughout the morning. Among them, the former Labour Foreign Secretary David Miliband. He'll be with us at 8:10 to talk about whether cuts to the international aid budget have hampered how we are dealing with the new Ebola outbreak. And we'll also be joined by the comedian Tim Minchin, who's calling to back the arts and authenticity over AI.
You could ask AI to write a speech in dactylic tetrameter and tell it to pitch it to a black tie crowd in a posh room, and I wager in 1,000 years it would not write that one.
Also in the programme.
And it is a privilege for me to be here as a member of your graduating class. Yeah, baby! Only 61 years!
The tennis legend Billie Jean King racking up another win, graduating at the age of 82.
I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport, and it's dubbed the richest game in football. Thought to be worth around £200 million to the winner, and after all the drama of Spygate, we'll finally be looking ahead to the Championship playoff final between Hull City and Middlesbrough.
Before that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Lisa Costello.
The BBC understands that UK officials have suggested to the EU setting up a single market for goods as part of the next phase of the government's Brexit reset. Industry figures briefed on the move say the idea is not currently being taken forward after the EU expressed scepticism and while trade negotiations are underway on food, farming and energy. The proposal suggests the government has significantly raised its ambitions for a closer post-Brexit relationship ahead of a summit in July. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, reports.
For weeks, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister have been publicly calling for a much closer economic relationship with the EU in the next phase of post-Brexit talks. There's been little public detail of what that has meant beyond existing talks on single market treatment for the trade in food, farm products, electricity and emissions trading. It's now emerged that UK officials suggested that the agenda for the next summit could be much more ambitious, with one option covering frictionless trade within an EU-UK single market for all goods. The government did not confirm the specifics of any conversations, but acknowledged that a range of options were put to the EU in recent months and conversations are ongoing. British business groups have been briefed on the move, and the EU's pushback that such an ambitious ask would not be negotiable with the government's existing red lines on, for example, freedom of movement. Some ministers believe that significant recent changes in the US posture to Europe might lead to more flexible thinking in continental capitals about the opportunities of economic reintegration between the UK and EU. A summit is expected in July.
Cases of the Ebola virus have now been reported across several areas in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which have been affected by conflict. The World Health Organization yesterday raised its risk assessment for Ebola in the country to very high, with the global risk remaining low. The species of Ebola that's behind the outbreak has no proven vaccine. Emery Makomeino reports from the capital, Kinshasa.
The authorities say there are now outbreaks in eastern part of the country, including Ituri, North Kivu and South Kivu. No cases have formally been declared in the regional capital, Goma, although there has been one positive laboratory test. So far, more than 700 have been exposed to the virus, with over 170 suspected deaths recorded. More than 1,600 people are now being monitored as contacts of contacts. The outbreak involves the Budibungio species of Ebola, and the World Health Organization has raised the national risk level to very high. There are growing concerns the disease could spread further in areas affected by insecurity and weak health systems.
State media in China says more than 80 people have been killed following a gas explosion in a coal mine in northern Shanxi province. 9 miners are missing. Officials coordinating the rescue operation say the mine's managers have been taken into custody by the police. China's President Xi Jinping has called for a thorough investigation. Elon Musk's company SpaceX has completed a highly anticipated test flight of its redesigned Starship rocket, which NASA hopes to use in future missions to the moon. The new version is the biggest yet. A planned launch on Thursday was postponed because of last-minute technical issues. From Washington, Joel Gunter reports.
At more than 40 stories tall, SpaceX's Starship is the largest and most powerful rocket in history. Last night, the latest iteration of the spacecraft blasted off from a new launch pad in South Texas, powered by 33 of the company's Raptor engines.
5, 4, 3, ignition. We have liftoff.
Once in space, Starship opened its payload doors and deployed 20 dummy satellites before making re-entry and, just over an hour after launch, splashing down in a landing zone in the Indian Ocean. Both stages of the rocket suffered engine failures, but the test flight was largely successful, a result that will likely boost confidence both for investors, ahead of a planned public offering next month, and for NASA, which intends to use the Starship vehicle in future missions to the moon.
The BBC's learned that from Wednesday, the government-backed bank National Savings and Investments will begin contacting the personal representatives of tens of thousands of former customers whose money it kept after they died. The bank apologised and its chief executive left his job when the details emerged in March. Paul Lewis from Radio 4's Moneybox reports.
The exercise announced this week will put right a major error which NS&I first admitted to publicly in March. It had known since last December that when a customer died, it did not identify all the accounts they might have held. The bank now says it had wrongly kept £367 million belonging to the heirs of 34,000 customers. Any amount of £10 or more will be paid in full, plus interest, with any necessary expenses paid on top. This week, ministers announced that no inheritance tax or income tax will be due on this money. NS&I says no one needs to contact it directly and hopes to have handed back all the money by the middle of next year.
Amber health alerts for hot weather are in place across the Midlands, the east of England and London and the south east, with temperatures expected to reach 30 Celsius today. The warning means there's an increased health risk to people who are vulnerable, including the elderly. Yesterday was the warmest day of the year so far, with a peak temperature recorded of 28.4 Celsius. The Red Arrows will fly with fewer aircraft at most displays this summer. The RAF says it's preparing for the future of its aerobatic team. Greg McKenzie reports.
The RAF's Red Arrows will perform with 7 aircraft instead of the usual 9 at most air shows this year, as the ageing Hawk T1 fleet moves towards retirement. The RAF says the change will help manage engineering resources and prepare for a transition to a future aircraft type. Despite the reduction, full 9 aircraft formations will still appear at key events, including the King's Birthday flypast and 4th of July commemoration. In the United States, the Hawk jets are due to remain in service until 2030, although maintaining the aircraft is becoming increasingly difficult as parts and engines become harder to source.
The winner's been announced of a competition to turn half the timber saved from the Sycamore Gap Tree into an artwork. Helix Arts, a charity, and George King Architects have been given the commission by the National Trust after a public vote and deliberations by an expert panel. Rebecca Drought reports.
When the sycamore that had stood on Hadrian's Wall for more than a century was illegally felled in 2023, it became clear how widely loved it was. People described visiting at times of celebration and also of grief and reflection. Helix Arts, based in North Shields, and George King Architects from London are hoping to use these memories in their collaboration called The People's Tree. They plan to record the public's reflections on their relationships with trees, which will be put to a soundtrack created by scanning the rings of the sycamore. The project will culminate in an artwork that includes some of the tree's wood, as well as the archive of stories.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Thanks so much, Lisa. It's 7:10. With Donald Trump so distracted by Iran and by Cuba, the possibility of fruitful US-coordinated peace talks between Russia and Ukraine, talked up so enthusiastically just a few months ago, seem a far-off prospect. In fact, both sides have stepped up their attacks. President Putin says he's ordered Russia's military to prepare for possible retaliation after a Ukrainian drone attack on a building he said was a student dormitory in Russian-occupied eastern Ukraine. 6 people died in the attack. Ukraine denies targeting civilians. Well, on the line to me now is Lesya Vasilenko, a Ukrainian MP for the opposition Holos Party. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, is Ukraine responsible for this attack in Luhansk? President Putin describes it as a terrorist attack.
Ukrainian soldiers have not been known to breach international humanitarian law. And if such breaches ever occurred, starting from 2014, when Russia initially annexed Crimea and started their aggression, Ukraine would take measures. We pride ourselves and our military prides itself that we are saving human lives, be it the lives of our soldiers who are sent into battle or the lives of civilians for whom we are fighting, especially the lives of civilians on our own land that is being under occupation by Russia. Well, what exactly happened with the facility, which is said to be a dormitory, remains to be investigated. And if Russia was letting independent investigators and the Red Cross and the likes into their territories, things would be much easier. But what I can say for certain is that many of the buildings which were once hospitals, education facilities, schools, kindergartens, student dormitories, they are no longer serving that purpose, as Russia usually repurposes such buildings to house their own military or to launch military operations from.
Lesya Vasilenko, why target occupied eastern Ukraine, though, with the risks involved? I mean, Ukraine has been increasingly targeting sites deep inside Russia, including energy installations. But again, why eastern Ukraine?
Eastern Ukraine has been under occupation since 2014. Some cities have fallen under occupation since 2022. Like Crimea, Russia is using many sites in eastern Ukraine to launch attacks onto Ukrainian troops and receive military gains as a result of that. So Ukrainian military tactics, they are a combination of both. Deep strikes inside of Russia to incapacitate Russia's war machine and Russia's war economy through targeting the oil plants, the energy fuel production facilities, the military facilities, but it's also the mid-range and the immediate strikes which are needed to push back Russia and push Russia out from our own territory.
Lesya Vasilenko, Ukrainian MP for the opposition Holos Party, thank you.
It's 13 minutes past seven now. We're here in Hay on Wye this morning, and actually a major new charter that recognises the rights of the River Wye is being launched this weekend. And it's a really significant moment in the growing rights of nature movement across the UK. This particular one is believed to be the first full catchment river charter in the whole of the UK. It is the first rights of river framework for a Welsh river. And what it does is unite all of the local authorities under the shared purpose of trying to protect the river. And who better to tell us a bit more about it than Robert McFarlane, the author of Is a River Alive?
The Wye, one of the great rivers of these islands, is slowly dying. Between them, government, national agencies and industry have not stopped its decline. And so, instead, people have stepped in. A river guardianship movement of citizen scientists and campaigners has sprung up among the many communities who call the Wye's watershed their home. And now, inspiringly, we have Herefordshire County Council approving a charter for the River Wye that proclaims the intrinsic value of the river and recognises its rights to flow, to be free from pollution, to be protected from harm. Think of it, a river as a rights-bearing subject. It's a revolution. If the council can now unite its powers with the energies of the river guardianship movement in the region, it could pioneer real change from below, change rising from the riverbank up to drive forwards a future with a clear-running, vibrant and vital River Wye at its heart. Give rivers a chance and their life pours back, and with it ours too.
That's Robert McFarlane. Well, Dr. Louise Bodner is here, the voice of the River Wye, speaks on behalf of the river, also an ecologist. Morning, Louise.
Good morning.
Sounding beautiful. How is the River Wye this morning?
Well, looking beautiful in the sunshine, but underneath the waters there are, you know, many problems. She's one of our most beautiful rivers, and one of our most highly protected, but still suffering the ecological decline, the decline of the species in the river because of, sadly, agricultural pollution.
Yeah, I mean, we followed the Wye on the programme for a while now, and it the Wye's story is very similar to rivers across the country. But tell us a bit more of the detail, because we feel like we know more about the problems of river pollution now, but it is still happening.
It is still happening because our laws are not being enforced. We need the laws to be enforced, and we need new laws. You know, in the 19th century, we created laws to deal with sewage pollution. In the 20th century, we created laws to deal with industrial pollution. And in the 21st century, we need laws to deal with industrial agricultural pollution. And at the same time, we need support for farmers to transition to, you know, river-friendly, nature-friendly farming. You can get grants for slurry stores, but you can't get grants to process the food that you grow, the raw materials, into the food that we buy. So we need changes within the system. Food as local farmers don't grow food for local people anymore. Food has become a global commodity that's traded in markets controlled by just five companies. You know, it's an obscene model that we have that, you know, for profit, everything and everybody suffers.
So when you're out there, as we said, you speak for the river. So you will stand up at meetings where things are being discussed, decisions are being made. It's clearly important to have somebody making that point, right?
Yeah, I think it's very useful. I'd encourage other local authorities to do it. So I embody the right to representation and give the river a voice. In our meetings, I have a vote as the river, and in the Catchment Partnership and Herefordshire Council's Nutrient Management Board, I speak as the river, for the river.
And do you feel listened to when you speak as the river?
Yes, and it brings a different perspective. You know, the river is ancient, and the river brings that perspective of deep time and life moving in cycles and a greater understanding of change over the long term, we can get very focused on the idea of single, simple solutions or instant approaches caught in a very narrow time frame. And often we come from our own perspective, whatever our interest group is. So as the river, you represent all of the species within the river without any human interest to try and get that point across that their rights and needs are as important as ours, and we have to adapt to what they need.
Yeah, and as you said, it was sounding really beautiful listening to it this morning, and it's such a sunny weekend ahead that I'm sure people will be enjoying it as well. Thank you, Dr. Louise Bodner, with us this morning, who is the voice of the River Wye. It's 19 minutes past seven now. We are, of course, here at Hay on Wye. It is the UK's biggest literary festival here. We've got an audience as well, by the way. Good morning again, everyone. They're sitting beautifully quietly and well-behaved, but they are here. And one of the real features of this site, which I know you will all have explored already, is a bookshop, a huge bookshop here, which is always busy. And this is a big weekend for the publishing trade. The trade altogether, when you look at publishing in the UK, it contributes around £7 billion to the economy. So it's big and it's important. But of course, it raises questions about how it's faring in the age of social media and self-publishing, people's ability to get their own work out there now to a wide audience, should they choose to. So Frederick Studman is here, the former chair of judges for the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction, literary editor at the Financial Times. And Anne Bricktoe is with us as well, runs four bookshops here in Hay, including Addiman Books, which opened back in 1986. Murder and Mayhem as well. I can guess what you sell there. Good morning, Anne. Hello, Frederick.
Morning.
Good morning. When we talk about, I mean, obviously, when you're somewhere like this at Hay Festival, you can see that the publishing industry appears to be in rude health. When we broaden it out, Frederick, how would you assess things at the moment?
Well, I think it's obviously a very particular reflection because we're out and about at a literary festival on a wonderful morning like this. But I think generally, I would actually say I think publishing is in quite robust. It's quite a robust state. You mentioned, I mean, the money, that the sales are very strong. You could have added exports. Britain is, I think, the biggest publishing export market, exporter of books around the world. You've got this exorbitant privilege of the English language, which means books published here are accessible to readers all around the world. It's quite amazing. And, you know, you've got a lot of sort of excitement around new, you know, there's lots of shifts happening within reading habits. So right now you've seen, you know, a lot of excitement around certain types of fiction that are in the fantasy realm or the romanticy realm, and other things maybe are not doing as well. But it feels still very vibrant. And I mean, I wouldn't be the first person to say it, but I think it's perhaps fitting since we are literally sitting in a field. Publishers are a bit like farmers, you know, they're always moaning. It's always either too wet or too dry. And actually, things are just going on, and if I can extend that horrible that metaphor a bit, I mean, their harvest is this. A lot of them have these remarkable backlists, and that's where they're making a lot of money, because we're all still going out and buying books that came out 10, 20, 50 years ago. And that sustains them and gives them the ability to experiment with new ones. There's a bigger discussion about whether they are investing in the right areas, backing the right authors, where the money is being divvied up at the end of the day.
But yeah. Oh, that's an interesting point. We'll get on to that. And how do you find it in the bookshops, Anne? Are people still coming in? Are they still, I mean, do people still read paper books the way they used to? Have people gone online now? Are they reading on phones or Kindles, whatever they may have?
I've been selling books for over 40 years now. And when I started selling, you had a hardcore of probably 30, 40% of the population would read a book. Now, that has decreased over time. But the passion of the 20% that still read and buy books and promote them on BookTok or Bookstagram and just love the feeling of books, the energy has grown, and that's what I've found. The publishers have responded really well. So here I have a great classic, Pride and Prejudice. And
that's a beautiful looking version.
A beautiful looking book with sprayed edges showing peacock feathers. I mean, we are selling plain ones for £8.95, these for £15, this for £20. A beautiful book when I was younger would have been more than this with inflation now. So the book prices have come down. It's affordable, it's fun, it's visually appealing. But what you were saying is, I think in now we've noticed that highlights are selling. So you'll sell Emma, Pride and Prejudice, sometimes Persuasion, Sense and Sensibility, but you won't sell Mansfield Park and Northanger Abbey. And so things are very particular. Certain authors save our lives at some stage. There was one a few years ago, February, we didn't think we'd be able to pay our staff, and then someone came in and bought a first edition of The Hobbit, which paid all the wages.
Yes. Can I ask how much that was?
Well over £1,000. Wow. Yeah. With a wrapper, it goes for a lot, lot more, but really? It was a nice copy, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And you said, Frederick, you talked about where the industry invests and where it promotes new authors. And obviously, Anne was talking there about some of the classics. There's a real rise in celebrity books nowadays, which we know can drive huge numbers in terms of sales, but people can be a bit sniffy about that. They'll say, why should a celebrity write a book? What's their qualification for that? Where do you stand on that argument?
Well, I mean, you can you can see what they're doing, which is you invest in, you know, half of the thing is getting noticed, and a celebrity is a big brand already, so that's already done that job for you. I mean, I don't think it's bad in itself, and evidently readers want to read those books, or quite a few of them do, but there is an element where you feel the money is and the attention and all the effort that goes into marketing, to backing a book, which is quite significant, is concentrating it around a limited number of authors, titles that the publishers think will be successful. And there is a bit of a self, it doesn't always work, but there is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that. Mm. And I have a lot of sympathy for authors who maybe feel that, you know, their book is kind of comes in, gets a little bit of, you know, some publicist emails me and says, can you do anything with it? And then it's sort of everyone moves on.
Yeah.
And they're not getting that. And that there is an imbalance there. And I think, I mean, the other bit that I was referring to is also where publishers are actually quite profitable. They don't tell you this, most of the big ones. and it's where does that money go, you know, at the end of the day?
Oh, I see, where they're investing.
But no, both sides, what you said, investing, but then also where you divvy up at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can, I mean, it's a bit sniffy to sort of say, oh, you know, as you said, not another ghastly celebrity memoir, but, you know, if people want to read it, that's fine, you know. Yeah. But I do think it leads to imbalances elsewhere.
Yeah, it is an ongoing argument, isn't it? And obviously, Anne, you have the benefit of, it must be lovely because people come into the shop and they talk to you about what they enjoy reading, and you can recommend things to them. And so you get that real sharp end feedback from people.
So they might come in, as you're saying, and buy David Walliams, but you can sort of steer them towards some of the old classics as well. And if I can get an I Capture the Castle into a teenage girl's hands while she's buying a more celebrity-based author, then I feel I've really scored. I've managed it. But there's also that thing about when people start buying books in their teens, early teens, and then they go on and suddenly they've decided they might, they've studied Hardy at school and they like Hardy, and then that you encourage them as a sort of, when they're a university student, they come in with their parents and they decide to get a first edition Hardy as a 21st birthday present. So I can see them go from just a reader to a collector.
Yes.
And the rise of specialist shops, you were talking about Romantasy, and now we've got Gay on Y, which has increased the traffic in one of our streets 100%. We have more people coming just to go to Gay on Y. A few months ago, a sci-fi shop opened. A dear colleague of ours, opened a second shop, which is really exciting.
Yeah. So broadening out all
broadening
the time,
out,
as you say,
but
more people.
Specialized shops. Is sort of the way to go.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Look, thank you so much both, Frederick Studeman and Anne Bricto. Speaking of books that you might like to read, of course, because we're at the Literary Festival at Hay, we'll have an edition of Book Club as well in the last half hour of the programme before 9 o'clock too. It is 27 minutes past 7 now.
And that means it's time for the sports news with Sarah.
A very good morning to you. Right, George Russell, he has beaten Mercedes teammate Kimi Antonelli to sprint pole at the Canadian Grand Prix. The Briton, who is 20 points off the Italian after four races this season, was fastest on both runs in final qualifying. In rugby union, Ulster's 20-year wait for silverware continues after they were comprehensively beaten by Montpellier in Bilbao in the Challenge Cup final. Leeds are back on top of Super League after thumping bottom of the table Huddersfield, while Lee beat Hull FC. And Somerset began the defence of their men's T20 Blast Crown with a 7-wicket win over Hampshire. You can see all the results from all the men's and women's matches on the BBC Sport website. Now, it is a bank holiday weekend in May, so today is stuffed full of football finals starting at 12:30 with the WSL and WSL2 playoff between Charlton and Leicester. At 3, it's the Scottish Cup final between Celtic and Dunfermline, with the Championship promotion playoff final dubbed the most expensive game in football at 3:30 between Hull City and Middlesbrough. Delighted to say, Five Live Sports presenter Aaron Paul joins us this morning, ahead of no doubt going to Wembley. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Sarah.
Now, to say the build-up to this final has been dramatic is probably an understatement. Can you please explain Southampton's expulsion from the playoffs and Spygate in around, 20 to 30 seconds?
Oh, I'll try. I mean, wow, this is something that the Football League has never seen before in the 40th anniversary year of the playoffs. I don't think anyone would imagine that Southampton would be expelled from the playoffs. The long story short is that the Southampton head coach, Tonda Eckert, admitted to, sending junior members of staff out to spy on Middlesbrough, Ipswich and Oxford United. It all came to head because a Southampton junior intern analyst was spotted in some trees near the Middlesbrough training ground. Long story short, that Southampton expelled from the playoffs, losing their place at Wembley. They received a 4-point deduction. The independent commission that came to decision said that the integrity of the competition was seriously violated. The EFL commission, who conducted the first investigation, called it contrived, determined and deplorable. And now the Football Association has opened a separate investigation, and we wait with bated breath to see what happens with Southampton.
I mean, Aaron, it was a little over 20 to 30 seconds, but I'll let you off just this once. Now, of course, all of this means that Borough reinstated despite losing their semi-final and onto the match itself. So it's fifth versus sixth. Who's actually favourites for this?
I don't know. That's the worst thing. I mean, if you ask anyone, that they find it very, very strange. Hull, of course, come in with the momentum, having actually beaten Millwall, having had a really strong end to the season. With Middlesbrough, though, they returned to training this week. Kim Hellberg's side knew they'd be playing in the final on Tuesday, and so they've had sort of a week, maybe 8 days less to prepare for this game. They didn't have a good end to the season. They're going to be missing key players as well. We're still sweating on the fitness of Hayden Hackney, but Tommy Conway has scored 14 league goals and he'll be missing through injury, so it's unpredictable.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for your time this morning. Many say that winning the playoff final is the best way to get promoted to the Premier League. We'll have to wait and see how Hull and Borough fans feel about that. You can stay across all of today's finals, of course, on the BBC Sport website and app.
Thank you, Sarah. And here's Matt Chorley to tell us what's happening on tomorrow's Broadcasting House.
This week on BH, Andy Burnham's old cabinet colleague Alan Johnson on his Westminster comeback, how to keep on keeping on in number 10 with Theresa May's chief of staff, and pollster Scarlett Maguire on whether good figures on the economy, the NHS and immigration can help Keir Starmer stage a comeback. Oh, and did the CIA poison England's goalie Gordon Banks to help Brazil win the 1970 World Cup? That's BH, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Don't be late.
28 minutes to 8 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster at Hay Festival and Katja Adler in London. And Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The BBC understands that UK officials have suggested to the EU setting up a single market for goods ahead of a summit in July. Business figures briefed on the proposal say the EU has expressed scepticism because of Downing Street's red lines, such as on freedom of movement. The government says a range of options were put to the EU and conversations are ongoing. The Democratic Republic of Congo says Ebola cases have now been reported across several conflict-hit eastern provinces. The World Health Organization yesterday raised its risk assessment for the outbreak to very high. 177 suspected deaths have been recorded and more than 700 cases.
Chinese state media says a gas explosion in a coal mine in northern Shanxi province has killed more than 80 people. 9 miners are missing. Officials coordinating the rescue operation say the mine's managers have been taken into custody by the police. A highly anticipated test launch of the biggest and most powerful rocket ever built, SpaceX's Starship, has been completed. The vessel's 12th flight follows an extensive redesign to prepare the rocket to take part in NASA moon missions. The test was largely successful and under heightened scrutiny ahead of the debut of Elon Musk's company on the US stock market next month with an estimated $1 trillion valuation. The BBC has learned that thousands of bereaved people who were not paid all the money that their deceased relatives had kept with a government-backed bank are to be contacted from Wednesday. National Savings and Investments wrongly kept more than £360 million after 34,000 customers died. The bank has apologised and said it hopes to return all the money by the middle of next year. Health alerts for hot weather are in place across the whole of England as temperatures could reach up to 30 Celsius today. Yesterday was the warmest day of the year so far, with a peak temperature recorded of 28.4 Celsius.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It is 26 minutes to 8. When is a child able to judge right from wrong? What should the age of criminal responsibility be? The government says it's going to review the sentencing this week of three teenage boys who raped two teenage girls in two separate attacks, which they filmed and posted on social media. On Thursday, the boys were given non-custodial sentences, youth rehabilitation orders to be precise, and they walked out of court with 11 rape convictions between them. Speaking on this programme yesterday, the former safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, slammed the sentences as unduly lenient. And all of this comes the same week as Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy published the new Youth Justice White Paper. It says it'll carefully consider whether the age of criminal responsibility, that's 10 years old in England and Wales, in Scotland it's 12 years old, still reflects the modern understanding of childhood vulnerability and development in today's society. Well, joining me now to consider the age of criminal responsibility is Wendy Joseph, former Old Bailey criminal judge and author of a book called Rough Justice. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Katya.
And Kirsty Brimelow joins us as well, the chair of the Bar Council of England and Wales. Good morning.
Good morning.
Starting with you, if I may, Wendy Joseph, a government spokesman said the Attorney General's office received multiple requests for the sentences of the case we mentioned to be reviewed. That's under the unduly lenient sentence scheme. So members of the public can go to this government webpage and ask the Attorney General to look at the outcome of a particular case. What's your view on the sentencing of these boys? Too lenient or not? How much does age play a role?
Well, age obviously plays a role. The judge in sentencing them has to look very, very carefully at their ages, and there are guidelines for this. But had there been an adult committing a crime like this, two young victims, all sorts of aggravating features, there was a knife present, although it wasn't used, there was photography, you'd be looking at a sentence for an adult in many, many, many years. You'd be looking at 15 years plus for two offences like this. Where you've got children, particularly as young as this, the judge slashes that sentence. So you might be looking at a sentence of half or less than half. But this judge has come to the conclusion that help is required rather than punishment. It's a brave step to take, and we'll see what the Court of Appeal says about it if it goes up to the Court of Appeal. You can see why he's done it, because the law says that children's welfare takes precedence over most other things. Mm.
And the judge did say he wanted to aid their rehabilitation into society. Kirsty Brimelow, you're publishing a report soon on increasing the age of child criminal responsibility. You know, with the age of 10 in England and Wales, that's one of the lowest in the world.
It's actually the lowest in Europe. And as you've said, it's 12 in Scotland. It is an outlier. And there's been successive reports and recommendations that the age be increased. It was last properly debated in 1963. There was some reference to increasing it to 14 in 1969. But this really is the first time that we're getting to grips with what we know about how a child's brain develops, the neuroscience. And also we have lots of data now about the background of the kids that come through the criminal justice system. They tend to be the most disadvantaged that we have in our society. Often they're the victims themselves of violence, of grooming, and that really hasn't been taken into account. So the question here really is not what particularly about the age of criminal responsibility. It's really the question really here is, are they best served? Is society best served by having children as young as 10, so between 10 and 14 in the criminal justice system, as opposed to being supervised and having their liberty curtailed in other ways outside criminalisation?
So, Wendy Joseph, what do you think? Because if you take society into account, are you protecting the children accused of a crime, or are you protecting society from crime? You've sentenced young children for murder, haven't you? What happened to them?
I've prosecuted them, I've defended them, and I've sentenced them. Look, Katya, I'm not sure that maturity is the be-all and end-all here, because it's absolutely true that a child of 10 does not have a mature brain. Neither does a child of 12 or 14 or 16. Modern knowledge tells us that the brain matures somewhere closer to 30. So there's a sliding scale here. And there are two questions that we need to ask ourselves. Whether you want to take children out of the prosecution system, out of the criminal justice system, or whether you want to retain that jurisdiction, at least for serious crimes like murder and rapes, and deal with them within the system in a different and more sensible way.
And in your experience, what's been successful if you have sentenced a child?
Well, I'll tell you what's not successful. It's not successful sending a 15 or 16-year-old into young offenders institutions where they then go on to prisons, because they are exposed to such bad regime there. They are exposed to such bad influences, such bad violence, and that violence is not being controlled at the moment, and they're not getting the education and training that they need. When I've prosecuted 12-year-olds and they've gone into custody for murder, they've gone into secure local authority accommodation where they were given, where they were locked up, but they were not locked up in cells. They were in homes, and they were being effectively given much more training and education whilst they were being punished. So there are very different ways in which you can tackle this, and many different things you can do to try and improve the system.
It's a very nuanced debate. Wendy Joseph, former Old Bailey criminal judge, and Kirsty Brimlow, chair of the Bar Council of England and Wales, thank you for your time.
It is 19 minutes to 8 now, you're listening to Today. We're at Hay Festival this morning. Tim Minchin is here. Yeah. Welcome.
I'm in a tent in Wales, and I should be in a bed in Australia.
Well, yes, but we're glad you're here.
I'm very pleased.
Yeah, we're going to talk about art in the world of AI, among other things. One reason why, let's just have a listen to this. This is your viral acceptance speech that you made at the G'day USA Arts Gala 2025. It's basically an annual event celebrating Australian talent in film, TV and music in the United States.
AI might come for the perfectible stuff, but never for our flaws. Our flaws are our humanity. Our art reflects our struggle to do better within our limitations. There are machines that can put a super high G into your ear hole, but a soprano singing a third below that will give us more of a thrill because we understand what it took for her to be able to sing it. You could ask AI to write a speech in dactylic tetrameter and tell it to pitch it to a black tie crowd in a posh room, and I wager in 1,000 years it would not write that one.
We talk so much. What were you going to say?
Oh, it's a bit obscure, that reference. The speech that preceded that rant I wrote in didactic tetrameter, which is a Dr. Seuss rhyme scheme, just because I was showing off. Anyway, I just thought I should explain that unless anyone's confused.
But what's interesting is, and that, as we said, that got a huge amount of pickup and engagement because we talk a lot, and we do here on the programme, about the intersection between AI and the arts and the creative world. And some people see that as opportunity. For some, it's really frightening. Where are you on that scale?
Well, I don't know, really. I think it's incredibly interesting. But I think there's this passivity in the way we talk about this technology and all technology, born of the fact that we have never managed to not uptake technology, even if we can see it's going to be bad. Basically, I say sometimes on stage that humans run the risk of conveniencing themselves into meaninglessness. Like if we find a tech that means we have to do less, we just use it, even if we can see it's going to be terrible for us. So I'm interested in, you know, the whole point of art is it's storytelling, right? What the culture is like the gestalt of all the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And I reckon we just should own art. I think if it's made by AI, I know it's not black and white, artists use AI and stuff, but basically my big sort of philosophical hot take, which is probably useless, is just no. Like, not like don't make it, like, not don't make it, but just go, well, that's AI slop or that's whatever, but let's call art the thing that humans do to try and express what it is to be human for the sake of other humans. And probably other than humans, I was just asking the audience about bowerbirds because I was thinking about, well, do animals have intent? Because the thing I say all the time about AI is art is not just content, it's content plus intent. And I don't believe, large language models have intention. Of course they don't have intention. People are very confused by the fact that they look like they have intention, but there's no intention. A bird building a nest out of blue things probably has much more intention than an AI, so maybe that's art, but the bots aren't doing art. And I think that's just an assertion. It's a story I'm telling you. Art is a thing humans do. I think that's a really helpful story. I'm going to keep telling that story.
Yeah. You've got an event at the festival and a book as well that you're going to be talking about, You Don't Have to Have a Dream. Is this something, because as I said, we talk about AI a lot. Is this something that you feel that a lot of your time and mental energy is going on at the moment? Or is it just part of the spectrum?
Oh, no. I'm more interested in AI is really where it intersects with the hard problem of consciousness, like, because we don't understand why we are conscious. And I'm really interested in the philosophical discussion about what it is to be conscious, and therefore, when we're going to know, how are we going to know when the bots think they are a thing, when the bots have a sense of self? In terms of its intersection with art, I'm just feeling belligerent about it. I'm not interested in asking, I'll ask ChatGPT, look, can you just help me find a rhyme, and it will start suggesting, like, oh, why don't you write a song like this? And I'm like, dude, you're an idiot. Like, you're talking to the wrong guy. You're not going to suggest a song idea to me. It's just dumb. And so I have no interest in it. But I, as I say, I'm belligerent. I think there's a sort of Luddite revolution. I've got this idea. I've got to write a song about weaving. Because, you know, the Luddites rose up against weaving machines. And I think artists are weavers. We're story weavers. And I want to start a new Luddism where we just go, nah, don't like it, going to trash the robots.
It's interesting, is it? Because throughout creation, artists, musicians, authors, whatever it is, you are inspired by and you learn from the people who go ahead of you, humans. But now it's it's tech that's learning tech from other scraping. People. And you can see that sort of anger and upset from creatives who, when it's human, is fine, but when it's a machine, it feels very different to them.
Yeah. And I'm honestly not really... I think it's going to be very interesting. I think it's sort of sad, but there's a interesting philosophical question there. Like, the bot scrapes everyone else's information and creates something out of its pieces. That's what we all do. We're not artists in a vacuum. Every time we construct a sentence, we're just taking everything we've ever heard and slightly reforming it to sound like it's our idea, but it's not. I just think it's this thing about intention. So at some point when you're using AI to make your art, you are handing over intention. And it feels to me as an artist clear that it is meaningful whether art is created with some intention. Like Tracy Emin puts a bed with a tampon in a gallery. It's not that what we needed was a bed with a tampon on it in a room. It's that Tracy Emin decided it was a good idea and we want to know why. And when we look at that artwork, we are contemplating why. It's the intention that interests us, not the object. It's not just content. And so I don't know, I'm going around in circles a bit here, but I think that's where I find the distinction easy and meaningful.
Yeah.
The rest is actually really interesting. The distinction between a large language model and a human brain when it comes to constructing sentences, I mean, they're not actually doing the same thing, but the distinction is curious. Yeah. But not particularly interesting to me. What interests me is intention.
And that exploration which continues. Tim Minchin, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for getting up so early
in
the morning.
Pleasure.
And coming to see us. Tim Minchin, everybody.
I love the sound of that studio. It's 11 minutes to 8 and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell from Welland Garden City.
Good morning. Those attending the National Cathedrals Conference in Bristol this week were asked a simple question. What is the role of a cathedral today? They reflected on a specially commissioned report, Living Stones, which offered some sobering conclusions about the future of English cathedrals. There was some good news. 77% of adults have visited a cathedral in the past 3 years. So this suggests that many people still see cathedrals as thin places where they can glimpse heaven on earth and, as one of the Psalms says, be still and know. But the more worrying statistic is that 3/4 of England's 42 Anglican cathedrals are in debt. The growing gap between income and repair costs is difficult to ignore. In his book, How Buildings Learn, the American writer Stuart Brand argues that buildings survive by adapting to the people who use them. Cathedrals have, of course, done this for centuries. And in a noisy digital age, they now face a new challenge: how once again to reimagine themselves. Now, many cathedrals rely on admission charges, concerts, exhibitions, cafes, and many other attractions to help cover their costs. For some, of course, this feels like an attack on the essential quality of what is, after all, a sacred building. It's a fine balancing act, to be sure. My own experience of cathedrals has shaped much of my ministry. York Minster was my home cathedral. I studied near Durham. I was ordained in Ripon and now serve as an honorary canon of St Albans Cathedral. This has given me a closer understanding of the challenges and of the opportunities facing cathedral clergy and their lay colleagues today. And I suppose perhaps the real question isn't how cathedrals can survive, but why they still matter. When I'm in the cathedral, I often notice that many visitors still come just looking for that moment to pause, to light a candle, to pray. I see people of all ages, and quite interestingly, a lot of young people, wanting to stop, to rest, to listen to the silence, if only for a little while. The medieval builders of these vast places, vividly imagined in Ben Hopkinson's novel Cathedral, could never have foreseen the technologies that now shape almost every aspect of modern life. But I'm pretty certain they understood that people would always seek out their wonderful creations, as a calm sanctuary in stark contrast to the world outside. And that, perhaps more than anything else, is what our cathedrals are still for today and why we need them to survive.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welwyn Garden City. It's 8 minutes to eight. Donald Trump, not for the first time, has left European heads spinning this weekend. That's after he announced yesterday that the US would send 5,000 troops to Poland, just a few days after he said a planned deployment of 4,000 troops to Poland had been cancelled. It is confusing. The US president previously also announced he's pulling 5,000 troops out of Germany. He's already removed troops from Romania. Well, Radek Sikorski is the deputy prime minister of Poland and its foreign minister. He's been at this week's summit of NATO foreign ministers in Sweden, along with the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He gave his reaction to the US decision.
I think there may have been some miscommunication. I think the president intended to withdraw some troops from Europe, but not from Poland, which is on the eastern flank and a particularly close ally of the United States. And it's now been straightened out and we're pleased.
Well, you say eastern flank. So basically the NATO calls its eastern flank those countries that are close to Russia. How much of a direct threat does Poland feel from Russia? How important are US troops to you?
Well, Russia is the long-term threat to the entire neighborhood, and Russia has been at war with us on a hybrid basis for a decade. We felt it. Western Europe didn't always acknowledge it, although in Britain, remember, you had death squads with Litvinenko and Skripal. But we've had arsons, we've had assassination attempts, we've had attempted blowing up of moving trains. We've had incursions of Russian drones into our airspace that we had to use our Air Force to counter. We've had cyber attacks on our finance system, on our hospitals, plus the usual espionage and disinformation.
And of course, you've got the war in Ukraine, which far closer to you than it is to us in the UK.
Indeed, when they bomb Western Ukraine, our citizen can hear it.
Did you speak to US Secretary of State Marco Rubio at the meeting just now in Sweden? He warned, and this isn't the first time that we hear this from the Trump administration, that the US will reduce its presence in Europe, which is at the moment for active troops, it's about 68,000 to 80,000 troops, isn't it? How far can NATO succeed without this US big beefed up presence? And of course, it's US capabilities that Europe relies on too.
Yes, I did thank Marco for his input into the president's final decision. And yes, the US has been signaling to us for some years, including in formal documents, the National Defense Strategy, the National Security Strategy, that the footprint in Europe will be diminished, that Europe needs to build up its conventional forces, and that we will have a NATO Mark III with strategic enablers from the United States, that Europe for the US is the number four priority. And we've pledged to increase our defense budgets. Poland is at 4.8% of GDP.
You're and the biggest defense spender in Europe currently, aren't you?
Lithuania, but of the big countries, yes. Lithuania and a couple of others are close. And if we do what we pledged to do at the last NATO summit at The Hague, then by the end of the decade, we'll have a military that Putin would be very foolish to attack.
It is a big if, though, isn't it, Radek Sikorski? But here in the UK, in France, in many European countries, governments are under intense pressure economically. So it's one thing making big promises on defence, and it's another delivering.
It's true that defence budget rise the closer you get to Russia, for obvious reasons. But Germany, a large economy with limited debts, is spending half a trillion on infrastructure and half a trillion on defense. And it's all because of Putin's aggressiveness. So, plus, remember, we have two new members, Sweden, a wealthy country, which has just beautifully hosted its first NATO ministerial, and Finland, which means that the Baltic Sea is now pretty much a NATO sea. And Russia is having to build facilities along an extra 1,400-kilometer border. Those are all strategic defeats for Putin.
The US, though, is the biggest, most powerful member of NATO by far. And as you say, Europe is no longer a top priority for the United States. So you talk about NATO 3.0, but shouldn't Europe start planning a future without NATO, or is it more planning for a NATO without the US?
No, we should have a different sharing of responsibilities. And remember, our task is only to defend Europe's territory. The US has a global presence. So we only need a small proportion of US resources to feel reassured that the cavalry is over the hill.
Radek Sikorski, thank you very much indeed for your time. Time now for a look at the weather with Matt Taylor. It's hot, isn't it, Matt?
Oh, it is hot, Katya, and it's set to get hotter for some. Let's put this hot spell into a bit of context. In the last 126 years, we've only had around 10 days in which May has seen temperatures around 30 degrees. We could see around 4 or 5 this week alone. This is an exceptional spell. It is still spring, and we're likely to see, if not on Sunday, but certainly Monday, the May national record for heat drop, both by day and also by night. But it won't be heat and sunshine right across the board. That's often the case here in the UK. So we'll start the details in Scotland, the far north and northwest. A lot more cloud here again through today. Maybe a few glimpses of brightness, a few spots of rain during the middle part of the day in the Western Isles, but otherwise most places will be dry. To Northern Ireland, South and East Scotland, varying amounts of clouds, some good sunny spells though, a breeze picking up through the afternoon, but it should still be feeling quite pleasant. For Northwest England, Wales and the Southwest, while some have got sunshine, there's actually quite a lot of cloud around at the moment, some misty low cloud at that. Most of it will burn off through this morning to leave sunshine for the afternoon. Could still be some mistiness though around the coasts of Devon, Cornwall and also the Isles of Scilly. As for the Midlands and Eastern England, some areas of cloud, a little bit of patchy rain in East Anglia right now, that will clear. Blue skies for the vast majority through the afternoon and feeling hot. Temperatures peaking across that Midlands southeast corner, 24 to 29, 12 to 22 elsewhere.
Gorgeous. Thank you, Matt. You're listening to Today with Katya Adler in London and Anna Foster at Hay Festival.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 23rd of May. Good morning. The headlines this morning. The BBC understands that the government has suggested the UK and the EU establish a single market for trade in goods as part of a post-Brexit reset. At least 90 people have been killed by an explosion at a coal mine in northern China, and the Democratic Republic of Congo says cases of the Ebola virus are now being reported in more parts of the country's war-torn east.
And we are live in front of an audience at the Hay Literary Festival in the Welsh town of Hay-on-Wye this morning, right? Right on the border we are between England and Wales, and speaking to big names this morning in art, literature, science and politics throughout the morning. You can hear the very hardiest festival goers are with us already for the early start. Among other guests, we'll be speaking to the former Labour Foreign Secretary David Miliband, who's here just after the news at 8:10. Have cuts to the international aid budget hampered how we're dealing with the new Ebola outbreak? We'll speak to him about that. And where better to revive our Today book club ahead of half term than here at Hay? So we'll be speaking to the award winning children's author Catherine Rundle, alongside the Children's Laureate for Wales, with books to inspire curiosity about the animal kingdom. Also in the programme.
And it is a privilege for me to be here as a member of your graduating class. Yeah, baby! Only 61 years!
Another win for tennis legend Billie Jean King as she graduates at the age of 82.
I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport, and we'll get the latest from Bill Bow after last night's loss for Ulster in Rugby Union's Challenge Cup final, as 2003 World Cup winner Paul Grayson joins us to preview the Champions Cup final between Leinster and Bordeaux.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The BBC understands that UK officials have suggested to the EU setting up a single market for goods as part of the next phase of the government's Brexit reset. Industry figures briefed on the move say the idea is not currently being taken forward after the EU expressed scepticism and while trade negotiations are underway on food, farming and energy. The proposal suggests the government has significantly raised its ambitions for a closer post-Brexit relationship ahead of a summit in July. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, reports.
For weeks, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister have been publicly calling for a much closer economic relationship with the EU in the next phase of post-Brexit talks. There's been little public detail of what that has meant beyond existing talks on single market treatment for the trade in food, farm products, electricity and emissions trading. It's now emerged that UK officials suggested that the agenda for the next summit could be much more ambitious, with one option covering frictionless trade within an EU-UK single market for all goods. The government did not confirm the specifics of any conversations, but acknowledged that a range of options were put to the EU in recent months and conversations are ongoing. British business groups have been briefed on the move, and the EU's pushback that such an ambitious ask would not be negotiable with the government's existing red lines on, for example, freedom of movement. Some ministers believe that significant recent changes in the US posture to Europe might lead to more flexible thinking in continental capitals about the opportunities of economic reintegration between the UK and EU. A summit is expected in July.
Chinese state media is reporting that at least 90 people have been killed in an explosion at a coal mine in the north of the country. The incident in Shanxi province appears to be a gas explosion. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
When a large explosion hit the Liu Shenyu coal mine, 247 workers were on duty underground. China's leader Xi Jinping has called for no effort to be spared to treat the injured and search for survivors. The cause of what appears to have been a gas explosion has not yet been revealed. In the early 2000s, China's coal mining industry experienced deadly accidents routinely, but in recent years, safety standards have been tightened. However, according to state media, this latest incident has already led to the detention of officials operating the Liu Shenyu mine.
The Democratic Republic of Congo says there are now cases of the Ebola virus in more parts of the country's war-torn east. The World Health Organization yesterday raised its risk assessment for Ebola in the country to very high, with the global risk remaining low. The species of Ebola that's behind the outbreak has no proven vaccine. 177 suspected deaths have been recorded and more than 700 cases. Jeremy Kneindijk was involved in responding to Ebola when he worked at the American development agency USAID, which has been shuttered by President Trump.
Many of the health response NGOs that had U.S. funding in Ituri province, the epicenter of this outbreak, as well as in other parts of eastern Congo, they're no longer getting U.S. funding. That funding has mostly not been replaced by anyone else, so they've just had to dramatically downsize their capacity in eastern Congo.
Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, has completed a highly anticipated test flight of its redesigned Starship rocket, which NASA hopes to use in future missions to the moon. The new version is the biggest yet. A planned launch on Thursday was postponed because of last-minute technical issues. SpaceX employees cheered as the rocket blasted off from its new launch pad in Texas last night.
5, 4, 3, ignition.
The spacecraft deployed mock satellites before it splashed down in the Indian Ocean and exploded as planned. In a post on X, which he also owns, Elon Musk described the flight as epic. The test was largely successful and under heightened scrutiny ahead of an expected $1 trillion debut on the US stock market by SpaceX next month. The Trump administration has announced that most immigrants seeking permanent US residency will now need to apply from their home country. The US Citizenship and Immigration Services said anyone in the country temporarily with plans to apply for a green card should do so at an embassy or consulate abroad. A spokesperson said the measure would reduce the need to find and remove those who decide to remain in the US illegally after being denied residency. Research suggests the government is likely to miss its target for creating or expanding school-based nurseries in England by a significant margin. Boosting nursery provision is a central part of plans to increase the availability of childcare and better prepare children for starting school. Here's our senior education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
School-based nurseries make up almost a quarter of all childcare places in England. In its manifesto, the government promised to open 3,000 more by 2030 to help with rising demand. But research by the Sutton Trust and the Social Market Foundation suggests that not enough schools without nurseries plan to set one up because of limited space and concerns about whether they are financially viable. The report also warns too few new nurseries are being placed in disadvantaged areas. The Department for Education says in future, councils will decide where new settings can open and family hubs can also be used. Early years experts say school-based nurseries are only part of the solution and warn that without enough funding and staff, access to early years spaces will remain a postcode lottery.
Police in Russia have been raiding bars, nightclubs and concerts in a move which critics say is an attack on freedom of expression. Moscow says it's clamping down on extremism and drug culture. The BBC estimates that over the past 12 months, 21 events have been raided, as Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
The events we've identified as having been raided included 15 concerts, and the other six were theatrical performances, festivals and parties held at nightclubs. Music fans have been telling the media, including the BBC, that they were threatened with guns, beaten, subjected to pro-Kremlin propaganda and pressured to join the Russian army. The police rarely say why they raid gigs and clubs, but media reports give reasons such as looking for drugs, extremists and LGBT symbols, which are banned in Russia. Independent Russian experts speaking from exile said the raids added to the atmosphere of fear and repression in their country.
Research seen by Radio 4's Moneybox programme suggests financial pressures are forcing many of the UK's 6 million unpaid carers to cut back on saving for retirement. Around a quarter of those who responded to a survey by the charity Carers UK said they had paused or stopped paying into a pension while looking after a relative. Dan Whitworth reports.
Whilst millions of households are facing financial problems because of the cost of living, Carers UK say those caring for a loved one face unique pressures. Things such as having to run medical equipment or to constantly wash and tumble dry clothes and bedding because of incontinence means energy bills can be high and difficult to bring down. The charity also says carers retire with just 80% of the UK average pension, with hundreds having to quit work or reduce their hours every day because of their responsibilities, creating what Carers UK describes as a cycle of poverty which is difficult to escape. Its chief executive is urging all carers to ensure they're getting any help they're entitled to and to seek advice if they need it to help make a claim.
The winner's been announced of a competition to turn half the timber saved from the sycamore gap tree into an artwork. Helix Arts, a charity, and George King Architects have been given the commission by the National Trust after a public vote and deliberations by an expert panel. Rebecca Drought reports.
When the sycamore that had stood on Hadrian's Wall for more than a century was illegally felled in 2023, it became clear how widely loved it was. People described visiting at times of celebration and also of grief and reflection. Helix Arts, based in North Shields, and George King Architects from London are hoping to use these memories in their collaboration called The People's Tree. They plan to record the public's reflections on their relationships with trees, which will be put to a soundtrack created by scanning the rings of the sycamore. The project will culminate in an artwork that includes some of the tree's wood, as well as the archive of stories.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 11 minutes past eight now. The World Health Organization has upgraded the risk that the new Ebola outbreak poses inside the Democratic Republic of Congo to very high. The global risk at this stage remains low as this number of suspected cases reaches 750 and the number of deaths closes in on 200. Scientists here in the UK are working on a vaccine. Medics in the DRC are responding as best they can. But what is notable this time is the hugely scaled back response from the international community. Now, back in 2015, over a decade ago now, I covered what was the world's most devastating Ebola outbreak. I was in Sierra Leone and it killed thousands of people in West Africa. One of the key things that brought that under control was the partnership between countries like the US, the UK, and local health services. The people, the money, all of that was vital. And today, things are different. With international aid budgets cut and charities, NGOs, the UN as well, all struggling to fund their work. Well, an ideal person to talk to about this is David Miliband, who's here at Hay, the President and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, former Foreign Secretary, of course, between 2007 and 2010. David Miliband, good morning.
Thank you, Anna.
When you see what is happening there, and it's not just that you're seeing it, it's that IRC, your organisation, is trying to do what it can. The difference in 10 years in your resource must be huge.
Yes, the difference is huge and it has a very direct impact on the spread of the disease. I mean, we were working in Ituri province, which is where the outbreak has come from. We were working in five parts of that province until March last year when the money was cut from the US government. We're not working there now in those three parts of the province that have been cut. And we warned then that as sure as night follows day, when you don't have proper latrines, when you don't have proper water and sanitation, when you don't engage the community properly, then you're going to take risks with the sort of outbreak that we've got. I just want to pick up one thing that you said, though. You used the word response. And you're right that the response is much lower than in previous outbreaks. But of course, this is a classic example where a stitch in time saves nine, a penny spent on prevention is worth a pound in response. And so this is such a profound example of the short-sightedness that comes with aid cuts, because in a connected world, those cuts come back and bite.
I want to talk about those aid cuts a little more. It's worth saying, though, because I think because we're in a post-COVID world now, and people think, and people have lived through that pandemic that spread through the air, but actually in the case of Ebola, it is, in theory, easier to contain because it spreads through bodily fluids. And as you were saying there, you talked about education, you talked about community engagement. If people know how to, for example, to not prepare a body after somebody's died from Ebola, for example, which is something that's culturally really important, or not shake hands, all of those things can actually make a huge difference when it comes to something like Ebola.
Yeah, in the end, it's not hospitals that stop Ebola outbreaks. It's education of a community so that when someone dies, the local tradition is that everyone touches the body. Well, that's a disaster. It's also worth saying that there's a 21-day incubation for the disease inside the body. So we haven't seen anything yet. I mean, the spread is much, much greater. This is a war-torn area, 120 different armed groups in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, across the borders, very, very dangerous. So the scope for this to arrive in Britain is limited, although there have been three cases in the US, but the local danger becomes a regional danger very quickly.
The reason I think your perspective on this is a particularly interesting one is because you are at the forefront of aid at the moment, of help, of that response that you talked about. But also with your political background, you know that it can be a really hard thing to sell at the ballot box. You were the MP for South Shields. That's where I grew up. It's an area that voted for Brexit. It's an area where if people are seeing their lives being difficult, it's really hard to say to people, we should spend money a very long way away on people that you can't see, that you don't know what their lives are like. So you know that difficult political balance, don't you?
Yeah, but I think that there are two things that are incredibly important. First of all, we should be spending money here. And of course, we spend much more money at home than we do abroad. We're talking about a fraction of the spending on the health service or education or anything else on foreign aid. So we've got to get this in proportion. Secondly, and I think this is a real responsibility for the aid sector, we've got to show impact. I would like to have a discussion with Nigel Farage about the aid budget when I say to him, we've delivered 35 million vaccine shots in six war-torn parts of Africa and North Africa at 2023, $3 a shot, 2024, $2 a shot, last year, $1 a shot, because people are right to be concerned about impact. They're right to be concerned about cost effectiveness. But I think you can make the argument with real examples. And actually, this Ebola example, pandemic preparedness, is an investment in all of our safety, not just an investment in the health and safety of people there.
You talked there about that you would like to have a conversation with Nigel Farage about this, but the fact is it's Sir Keir Starmer's Labour government who've cut the foreign aid budget. Have you had a conversation?
Yes, I have had a conversation.
You have, and so when you have that conversation, what
I mean, they say what they've said publicly, which is we've got hard choices. I say it's short-sighted to cut the aid budget when it's delivering not just for the people there, but it delivers for Britain. We're part of a global aid system, and it's been ripped apart. And that is an enormous, it's a moral challenge, and I think that we shouldn't shy away from that argument, but it's also a strategic and instrumental part of our foreign policy. And the world's more connected than it's ever been. And we're not going to build a more secure and prosperous Britain unless we recognise the global risks as well as the local ones.
We should talk about foreign policy. We should also talk about Labour leadership as well, which we will, and some of the choices that the government has made that you maybe agree with or disagree with. The front page of The Guardian this morning is talking about the government trying to pitch an EU single market for goods, which Brussels seems to not be particularly keen on. What is your position on the government's stance at the moment on Europe and how our ongoing relationship with Europe should look?
Well, I'm convinced that the security and prosperity of the UK depends on an institutionalised, deep and strong relationship with the rest of Europe. I'm absolutely convinced of that. The Russian invasion of Ukraine shows the way in which that's our number one security threat now. But we know our economy has been shrunk by 6 to 8% in the 10 years since Brexit, so there's an economic part of that. So when the government says we want a reset of our relations with Europe, I think that's a good thing. But then when I look that the reset so far is only worth £9 billion by 2040, and I remember that Britain is a £3 trillion economy, I'm left saying, no, we need a much higher dosage in our reset.
How high? I mean, do you advocate for rejoining the EU?
Well, I'm somewhat bemused by some of the commentary. I want this strong institutional relationship with the European Union. But then I know the deal we had until 2016 is not available now. We're not going to be able to get that deal again. I also know the European Union is changing profoundly. The big issue for Brussels today is not Britain joining, it's Ukraine joining. And Ukraine joining the European Union is going to mean a different institutional set of arrangements inside Europe. So just to give you an example, they're talking about associate membership for Ukraine. They're talking about different tiers of membership. So the question of what kind of docking are we going to do in with the European Union, it's the re-part of rejoin that I think we have to understand. The world is changing out there.
So you're not necessarily against the concept, but what you're saying is it would never be the way it was.
You don't think
it's the right thing for that reason?
It literally can't be the way that it was. We're not in a position to... I mean, the European Union wouldn't entertain us flipping and flopping. What we have to do is build a national consensus about our position with the European Union. I'm very happy with it as a long-term goal. What I think for this Parliament, we should be really driving our economic, political and other relations. There's a big debate about defence spending going on, as we know. It's affected the aid budget. There's something called the European Defence Mechanism, which is the proposal for a European-backed 800 billion euro defence package that would support all European countries inside the European Union and outside. We should be championing that. That would be us putting in for a mutual security funding arrangement that would help fund our own defence and European defence. Because the truth is, our defence is Europe's defence and vice versa.
Given all of that, is now the right time for a Labour leadership challenge?
Well, I'm concerned with what the government does for the country rather than who is running the country. Well, if we don't decide what we're going to do and have a clear path about the cause that drives the government, the signature policies that drives the government, that's what's important.
That's not what we're hearing at the moment, though, are we? We're seeing various people who would like to be in Downing Street already making a pitch. There isn't an official leadership challenge just yet. But that's my point. That is what the discussion is about. That's not what... And people say it's what the media are talking about. It's what Labour themselves are talking about.
I have noticed that, yeah. Yes. I did notice that. And there's plenty of open wounds, and I'm not going to add to them or put salt into them. What I think is absolutely critical... I mean, Britain is in the eye of a global storm. I mean, the global order is being ripped up. Our economy is being transformed by new technology. our welfare system needs to shift from a focus on older people to an investment in younger people, a million people between the ages of 16 and 24 not in education or training. We've got a massive debate to have in this country about how we spur wealth creation, distribute it fairly, reinvent the way in which government works. The government is 100,000 more people in government in civil service than there were before Brexit. We've got to reinvent the way we organise government.
So I'm all about...
If we spend all our time talking about who, not what, we're going to miss the point.
But the question is absolutely key. Do you think to achieve that, Labour needs a new leader? We need a new Prime Minister?
I think we need a much changed debate about the way in which we're going to serve the country. I am country-focused rather than party-focused, because this is still a country with... I mean, it's my home. You can tell I feel passionately about it. And when I say it's my home, it's my homeland. I'm not living here at the moment, but my work is based out of the US. But this is my homeland, and it's a country of enormous strength. Its politics has strengths too, which are often dismissed. I see a lot of American politics. There's a lot to be glad about British politics, I tell you. And we've got to guard our democracy. We've got to renew our democracy. And the Labour Party won a historic victory. Obviously, I was very pleased about that. It's got to be, when the world changes, we have to change. And in the 2 years since the general election, the world has changed fundamentally. And we can't sit there saying, the world's changed, but we're not going to change. And
so you think Labour needs to change again?
What we need to do, I tell you what, the way I would put it,
yeah.
The things we promised to do in our manifesto are being torpedoed by the things we promised not to do. And we've got to focus on the things that we promised to do, which were about rejuvenating the economy, about reforming government, about extending opportunity. That's the agenda that I think Labour needs to embrace. And it's going to have to do it with a radicalism and a fronting up with the public about the trade-offs that are essential to making government work today.
That didn't sound like a wholehearted backing for Sir Keir Starmer. You're not a politician anymore, but the ability for a politician's answer never leaves a former politician.
Telling you the truth as I see it.
David Miliband, thank you so much.
Thank
really
you
appreciate
much.
You being here this morning.
Thank you.
And Katya, you were listening, I know, with particular interest to that section about Europe. We referred to that story on the front page of the Guardian this morning. And the point that David Miliband was making was a salient one. You know, what is on offer is not necessarily what the UK government might be pursuing.
No, I think what we heard there from David Miliband, he said, you know, the world is changing and we in the UK have to change with it. That's something that European neighbours are very aware of as well. But when it comes to the minutiae of a relationship with the European Union, you're not talking to Paris and Berlin, you're talking to Brussels, to the European Commission in Brussels, which is like the executive arm. So, you know, when it depends what the UK is asking for, I think that is absolutely fundamental. And in the EU, you sort of hear people saying very similar things that they were saying just after the Brexit vote. What is it you want? And at the time, it was a soft Brexit, it's a hard Brexit. And now it's how close? When Keir Starmer says we want to get closer, how close? You can't have, and this goes to the Guardian front page, just a single market membership for goods, because the EU is built around what it calls the four freedoms: single market in goods, in services, in capital, so money, and people being the free movement of people. And that is something that is one of the Labour government's red lines. And Sir Keir Starmer promised, and it's in the manifesto, no to freedom of movement, no to the customs union, and no to rejoining the single market. It's not just about saying to the UK, you can't have, you know, you can't cherry pick, you can't have the good bits and not the more difficult bits. It's also because the EU's thinking about its future. It's thinking about the French presidential election next year and how strong Marine Le Pen's national rally is looking, whether it's her who stands or Jordan Bardella who stands for president. And if it looks better to be outside the European Union than inside, more tempting, then the EU worries about losing some very key member states. And when we look at the economic relationship,
Defence is different. The EU wants to be as close to us on defence as possible. But the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, so the trade agreement that we got with the EU after Brexit, most EU member states, they're quite happy with it as it is. It's those who do a lot of trade with us. So Ireland and the Netherlands and Germany, to a certain extent, Belgium, they say, look, let's get closer. Other member states aren't clamouring. If we want to get closer, we are always wanted as close or inside the EU. But they have their rules and they have an eye on the future as well. And they do worry right now about the volatility of our politics. If you make a deal with the current government, you know, will they still be in place in a few months' time? Might there be an early general election? Of course, Brussels is thinking about that too.
Mm. So, I mean, basically, it's as hard to predict as it ever was, really. It's all those different things that you describe there, Katya, and the conversations that will happen, summits that will happen, discussions that will go on publicly and privately. It's still an enormously difficult thing to come to some kind of agreement on.
It's always the devil is in the detail. It's such a cliche, but it's true. But I think when we look again, listen to your conversation with David Miliband, what is going on in the world? And I think that countries inside the European Union and the UK, they realise they share so many of the same values, so many of the same fears. And that is definitely bringing them closer together. We are miles away from those bitter days of the Brexit negotiations. That's a completely new partnership. There is more flexibility. What it will look like going forward, I mean, you know, who knows? You could throw that to the audience in your tent, I think.
I think they could probably spend the rest of the programme discussing it as well and considering it, as you say, lots to think about. It's 27 minutes past eight now.
And 12 Grand Slam titles. We're going to look at a bit of tennis now and more. Another 16 doubles, 11 mixed doubles matches. Billie Jean King is, I'm sure everyone with you, Anna agrees, an absolute tennis legend and taking down any sporting rival. But there was one major opponent she hadn't quite finished with until just now, and that is her university degree. So at the fabulous age of 82 this week, Billie Jean King received a Bachelor of Honours in History from California State University, Los Angeles. It's a course she left more than six decades ago to pursue her tennis career, and here she is marking the moment.
It is a privilege for me to be here as a member of your graduating class. Yeah, baby! Only 61 years!
61 years to finish a degree. When I spoke to Billie Jean, it seemed only polite to start off by offering my congratulations.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy. It's just, I'm still trying to wrap my arms around everything because I had so many people respond. I cannot tell you. It's many more than when I won Wimbledon. Of course, that was in the old days. Maybe now it'd be more like that. But it's just so great. And I'm really excited. I just wish my parents could have been there because I'm the first in our immediate family to finish college or university. So I'm happy I finally did it.
Can you tell us why was it that you weren't able to complete your degree 65 years ago?
I had to quit college and not finish because that was my one opportunity to become number one in the world. And that's always a dream I'd had since I was 10. I always wanted to be number one since I first picked up a racket. And so I accomplished that. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, you know, I haven't finished college. I should finish. It's been on my mind ever since I left school back in 64 or 5. So it's taken 61 years. Everybody's teasing me. And I want people to know that it's never too late, usually, if you can still think, you know.
I think that's what's so inspiring. Not just that you're 82 now, but, I mean, you're 82. You've achieved so much. So many of us say, oh, I must go and learn this, do this, learn a new language, a skill, or finish something in education, but you actually did it.
That's another one I want to do, but I don't know if I'll get to it. I'm going to definitely take music lessons again because piano was my first love and didn't quite have as much ability in that as I did in sports. So, but I want to go back and start taking music lessons, I think. I'm thinking about that. And then just so many things I want to get done before I'm out of here.
When you got your degree, you said, you know, tennis was your platform, but equality was your dream. And you did. You fought for equality for women hard. Tell us also about 1973.
You threatened to boycott the US Open, otherwise, unless you would get equal money. And that year, you played a match. Tell us a little bit about that, because it was watched by 90 million viewers worldwide on TV.
Yeah, it was huge. What had happened in 1968, I got 750 pounds. Rod Laver, who won, got 2,000 pounds. In 72, actually, after the finals, I said, the women aren't coming back unless we get equal prize money. And then as I said that, I went, oh, my gosh, I haven't checked in with the women. What have I done? So I went and I talked to the women and they said, oh, no, that's good. We'll stand by you. They said, go for it. And then you mentioned, Kylie, about playing Bobby Riggs the same year in September. You're right, about 90 million people. He'd been asking me for 2 years. I said no. Then he asked Chris Everett. He asked Nancy. He asked all kinds of people.
Bobby Riggs, wasn't he known as a, well, he enjoyed the reputation as a bit of a, should we say, a
chauvinist
man's
pig?
Man, a bit of a chauvinist.
Chauvinist pig is what he liked. they called him a chauvinist pig in the United States. And he didn't carry love. And he had a gambling challenge problem. And he loved to gamble. So that was, he loved, this match for him was a total, he'd dream come true because he loved to bet on himself. And when I beat him, he jumped over the net and he whispered to me, he goes, I underestimated you. And my dad used to tell my brother and me, whatever you do, always respect your opponent, even if you don't like them. Always respect them. And my parents came to that match. They hardly ever watched me. They came to Wimbledon once in 1968. And so I was like, oh, I can't wait to tell my daddy. A lot of great memories with that, because there's nothing like, everyone out there knows, winning. People really responded. Women got more self-confidence. Men were much more reflective. There was, a lot of times they'd be crying even. And they go, you know, I never thought about my daughter. And I met President Obama, and he brought up the match. He said, I was 12 years old when I watched that match. And he said, now I have two daughters to raise. And it made me stop and think about the gender issue. And he said, it's been very helpful to me with my daughters and thinking about gender issues.
When you graduated, what you told the 6,000 students there, I loved it. You said, have fun, be fearless, and make history. Do you think that's a lesson for all of us? And
of,
you know, reflecting back on your career and the sexism that you faced and you fought, do you think we live in a better world today?
In some ways, in other ways, we don't. I think these are very scary times right now. I think my generation needs to stay out of. We're too old. The people in politics, I find, are too old. We need to get out. I'm feeling apprehensive about the future generations. I want them to inherit a better world than we had.
Well, Billie Jean King, a real pleasure to talk to you. An inspiration.
Thank you.
As well. And good luck with that work that you're still pursuing to try and make everything a bit better with all the energy that you shared with us today. Thank you.
And I'm coming to Wimbledon. So I'm so excited. And I'm getting an honorary doctorate at Oxford. I'm so excited.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You'll have so many degrees, you won't know what to do with them.
No, it's what you do with your life now and tomorrow. Come on, everybody out there and listening, just go for it. Just believe in yourself, you know, you can do it.
Good advice for life from Billie Jean King. It's 26 minutes to 9 now. Time for the sport. Here's Sarah Orchard.
A very good morning to you. Well, and of course, it's a bank holiday weekend in May, so it's stuffed full of football finals. We start at 12:30 with the WSL2 playoff between Charlton and Leicester. At 3, it's the Scottish Cup final between Celtic and Dunfermline, with the Championship promotion playoff final at Wembley, dubbed the most expensive game in football, at 3:30 between Hull City and Middlesbrough. But in Rugby Union's Challenge Cup final last night, Montpellier thumped Ulster 59-26 to extend the Northern Irish's side 20-year wait for silverware. 2003 World Cup winner with England, Paul Grayson, was in Bilbao for Five Live last night. Good morning to you.
Morning, Sarah.
Were Ulster simply outmuscled?
Short answer, yes, they were. They started really well. Ulster got ahead early and then were pegged back. And I guess they got to half-time and there was a 14-point deficit. They were starting to creak, and then post-half-time, Bordeaux just hit the gas and Ulster had no answer.
And of course, the Challenge Cup final, a little bit like football's Europa League Cup final. We now move to the Champions Cup final, which is Leinster versus Bordeaux this afternoon. Now, Paul Grayson, you actually won this tournament with Northampton back in 2000. It's been through a number of different format changes. And before we get to today's final, do you think the tournament is as big as when you played in it?
Yeah, well, we all look back with rose-tinted glasses, you tend to consider your day the heyday. The changes in the championship are one of the things I find difficult is the fact that you're in a pool, but you don't play the people in your pool in the qualification process to get to the knockout stages. So your results are aggregated against other teams' results against other teams. And I think the good thing about how it used to be was that you played in your pool, you played home and away against your opponents. So if you had Bordeaux, you'd go away and play in Bordeaux, but they would come to you and play in Northampton or Leicester or wherever, and kind of the rivalry's built up. The way the tournament is set up now, you kind of don't really get a flavour of what's going on until you get to the knockout stages, even after the round of 16, the quarterfinals. Once you get there, it's magnificent. I mean, last night was a brilliant occasion, and today is an international in all but name, but with the extra flavour of all those club supporters travelling to watch their hometown teams.
And Leinster, they're aiming to win the Champions Cup for the first time since 2018. That's after losing in four finals since. How much scar tissue is there?
There must be a lot. In sport, you kind of park it and move on. Professional sport, you know, just listening to Billie Jean King there, live for today and tomorrow, that's about all you can control. But the gremlins that Leinster must have in the background of, please let it be this time. And then you're coming up against such a formidable team as Bordeaux, gremlins or not, the challenge for them is massive.
Well, Paul Grayson, thank you so much for your time this morning. There's full commentary on 5 Live this afternoon of Leinster against Bordeaux in the Champions Cup final with Paul and our rugby union correspondent Chris Jones live in Bilbao. Kickoff is at 2:45.
Thank you, Sarah. The time is 23 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katia Adler all alone in London and Anna Foster with a massive, fabulous audience at the Hay Festival. Time for a summary of the news now with Lisa Costello.
The BBC understands that UK officials have suggested to the EU setting up a single market for goods, but business figures briefed on the proposals say the EU has expressed scepticism. The government says a range of options have been put to the EU ahead of a summit in July. The Democratic Republic of Congo says Ebola cases have now been reported across several conflict-hit eastern provinces. 177 suspected deaths have been recorded. The former Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, now head of the International Rescue Committee, told this programme that global aid cuts had had a direct impact on the spread of the disease. State media in China say at least 90 people have been killed by a gas explosion in a coal mine in northern Shanxi province. The mine's managers have reportedly been taken into custody by the police. China's President Xi Jinping has called for a thorough investigation.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. 21 minutes to 9 now. Our regular Saturday panel looking back at the week's news are with me here at Hay Festival this morning, as are our wonderful audience. Good morning again. Zanny Minton-Beddoes joins us, Editor-in-Chief of The Economist and Professor Guy Standing, economist, one of the leading advocates of universal basic income, wrote a report for John McDonnell when he was Labour Shadow Chancellor under Jeremy Corbyn. Good morning, both. Lots of numbers to talk about this week. UK net migration has dropped to almost half of the figure of 2024. The ONS says inflation fell in April. UK economy unexpectedly grew 0.6% in the first quarter of the year. So let's break some of that down and let's start with those migration figures. They are, aren't they, Zanny, a source of it, you know, people pore over them, they find different ways to represent them. Let's dig into it. What do they mean, these new numbers that we've seen?
Well, as you say, Anna, they are surprisingly low. I mean, net migration has fallen dramatically, and that is something that the British people want. It is something that has been a goal of government policy. They are now the lowest figures since 2012, if you take out the COVID pandemic time. So really a big drop. But the salience of migration for people hasn't really changed. People think, half of people think that migration is still growing. And the reason is because I think that one of the concerns is the areas of migration that people focus most about, people are most worried about, so small boats, asylum seekers, they aren't coming down as much. What's really plunged is work visas, people coming legally to the UK to work. Now, some of that is the kinds of workers that perhaps we want to get British people doing, so more of the lower skilled work that we definitely will worry about that. But at the same time, we're also having far fewer visas for really high-skilled workers. And I think there's going to come a cost to that. So we'll have, I think, a British economy that will grow less fast with much, much less migration. And so it's what people have said they want. We'll see whether it's good for the economy going forward. But it's a dramatic shift. And I think, you know, the government has delivered on what it said it was going to deliver.
Guy Stanley, what's your interpretation of those figures?
Well, I think politically it's important that the number has come down as it has. And I think it will change the nature of populist politics in the next couple of years. As Zanny has just said, I think we have to... I'm an economist, and therefore I'm going to say that we need migrants. We need migrants because they have a certain energy, a diversity. And I welcome that, but I think they've been demonized to a ridiculous extent. But now that the numbers have come down, I think we're going to see the reality, which is that this populism is linked to the fact that the major problem in this country is chronic economic insecurity. Millions of people are feeling chronically insecure, and they're part of the precariat. And this past election that we've just seen, I'm calling the first precariat election, in the sense that the millions of people who are insecure, they deserted Labour. They deserted Labour because Labour had a vision, contrary to what Wes Streeting said, a vision which was based on Rachel Reeves' famous lecture in March 2024, the Mays lecture, where she pronounced what the vision was called Securonomics. And it was a promise to give capital and finance security in return for expecting higher foreign investment in this country, increased growth, and then from growth, higher living standards. But it won't happen. The growth is not leading to that. And so now we have a new debate. And I think the lower migration figures are going to change the tone of the debate.
Okay. I wonder, you talk about insecurity there, but I wonder, Zanny, and obviously, you know, the two of you, you study the economy in a way that most of us don't. And how much is insecurity linked to unpredictability? Because that seems to be a big part of what we're seeing now, the difficulty in actually being able to predict what might come next.
Look, I think people who... Yes, of course, insecurity makes people worry about where the world is going. But, you know, Guy is someone who has written about the precariat for a very long time. I think you make some very good points. But I guess where I would slightly disagree with you is I'm not sure that this government has articulated a vision. I think that's the problem. And I think the reason that they did so badly in the local government elections is that wherever you are, whatever you stand for, you just have no idea what this government is trying to do. And it can't articulate a vision. And that's the problem. And that's why, even though from net migration to growth, the figures, you're right, and I haven't been bad recently, but they're going to get a lot worse in the next couple of months, because we know, because of the war in Iran, we're going to see higher inflation. We've already seen much higher petrol prices. We're going to see worse economic news. And we have a government that is hemmed in by brutal fiscal realities, which are that we simply don't have the room to spend a lot more. We don't have the room to do that. And even, you know, the Andy Burnham and others have discovered very quickly that the bond markets matter. And you start saying things like, ooh, maybe defence shouldn't be part of the budget rules, and the bond markets react, and you have to suddenly say, actually, they will be. So the real problem I think we have is a government that has no vision that it can articulate. And one of the hopes I have that whoever ends up being Prime Minister can actually articulate a vision and can get something done, because that's what this country needs right now.
Which may still be Sir Keir Starmer. It's a final thought, Guy Standing. I wanted to ask you, from an economic perspective, and taking the politics out of it for just a moment, what needs to be done right now to try and deal with some of those issues that we're facing?
Well, those who know me will not be surprised that I say that we've got to have a policy to put us on the road to giving basic income security. Everybody in this country needs to have a feeling that they can get up in the morning with a sense of security to be able to face today, tomorrow, and the future. And we're not moving in that direction. Our universal credit system is a disgrace. lack of money wages and the lack of benefits for people doing many types of jobs a disgrace. And we need that vision. What I meant when earlier my comment was that they did have a vision. Starmer does have a vision. Reeves does have a vision. The trouble is they can't articulate it because they know that if they did so, many people would say, hey, I don't like your vision. That's the more reality. And if you read the May's lectures that Reeves has given, she lays out their strategy and they've kept to that strategy. It's just a lousy strategy.
Mm. Well, look, the debate, it's worth saying as well, we started talking a little bit about by-elections there, of course. There's one coming in Makerfield very soon. Full list of candidates, should you want to see it, you will find it on the BBC website. Our panellists this week, Zanny Minton-Beddoes and Professor Guy Standing, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's turn at 14 minutes to nine to books, because it would be rude not to, as we're at the UK's largest literary festival. Catherine Rundell is with us, as always, a regular on our book club, children's writer, academic. The next instalment of her Impossible Creatures series is out this summer. And a new face as well, Nicola Davis is here, children's laureate for Wales, zoologist. You're one of the original presenters of The Really Wild Show, which is extremely, extremely cool. And we're going to talk this morning about books that involve animals. So before, and we have our audience have a couple of fantastic suggestions as well. Catherine, what are you going to start us off with as an idea? Because yeah, we're around about half term, always looking for something good to read. What have you got for us?
So I think mine would be a classic. What I think is probably the Sistine Chapel of children's books, which is The Sheep Pig by Dick King Smith. I think it is, if perfection in this world exists, it is The Sheep Pig. And it has the finest last line of any children's book. That'll do, pig.
It's just so, so sweet, isn't it? From, well, and obviously when things turn into films as well, we get to know them a little better. I noticed, Nicola, that at that you sort of...
I love that.
I could see from your reaction.
It became a catchphrase in our family, that'll do, pig. So what I'm going to focus on, of course, because I'm a zoologist, is nonfiction. I think reading of nonfiction to children is something that perhaps we forget to do as parents and as grandparents. I'm looking out at this audience and speaking as a grandparent. So my choices are all nonfiction. And I'm starting with The Observologist, which says it's a handbook for mounting very small scientific expeditions. It's by Giselle Clarkson. It's wonderful.
What's that very beautiful creature I can see on the front?
Oh, look at that. It's a fly.
The
illustrations in this are wonderful because they're accurate, but it's written with great humour. The information is beautifully packaged and pitched, and it's laugh out loud funny also. So it's a perfect, perfect book to encourage children to explore the natural history on their doorstep.
I want to dive into our audience as well. Justin is here. Where are you, Justin? Morning. What's your suggestion for us?
My favourite book about an animal is Moby Dick, which I read many decades ago. I was blown away about a book about one man's obsession with the destruction of a whale, which ends up causing the destruction of everyone around him. But it's also a fascinating look at the story of whaling, its history, and its science. Although it's a book from the past, I believe it has great relevance to today as well.
There was a real murmur of approval in the audience there. And I wonder, Catherine, that's a good point that Justin makes, because animals in books, not just in children's books, they can be a really clever way to get into bigger themes and stories, can't they?
Exactly. So great books about animals are often great books about mankind, about the world itself. And I guess for children in particular, one of the great glories of books about animals is children have not yet become accustomed to the extraordinary beauty and strangeness of the living world. And so for them, it is a brilliant way to draw them into the very real, extraordinary miracle of nature.
Yeah. And Kate is here as well. Morning, Kate. Where are you?
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, hello there. What have you got for us?
So I like The Life of Pi by Jan Martel. I think it's really original. I think it's really gripping. I mean, who'd have thought a book about a boy and a few animals could be such a page-turner? It's an exciting survival story. I like the imagery. You can imagine what's happening. I like to read the book before I see the film and the plane. You can imagine what the animals are doing. And it's really clever. It's ambiguous at the end. You don't know, were these real animals or was it just a representation of the people on the shipwreck. I just think it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's a clever one, isn't it? Nicola, how do you feel as a zoologist? How do you feel when people maybe take animals in books and perhaps overlay things onto them which aren't necessarily accurate?
I have a lot of problems with anthropomorphism.
Do you?
But I can't be too critical of it now because I've written two fantasy novels with talking animal characters. So I can't be too horrible about it. But, just as Catherine said, they're a wonderful way of getting people to connect with the natural world. And although we can never really put ourselves inside the paws and beaks of another sort of living creature, we can at least try to make that leap into the stories of all the many millions of other earthlings with which we share our planet.
So when you're writing those characters, how much of it is coming from what you know and how much of it is coming from your creative imagination?
I always make sure that I'm rooting my characters in the zoology, in what I know about their senses, in what I know about their way of experiencing the world. So I do as much research as I possibly can. But of course, I can't get inside a tiger's head. So I do make an imaginative leap. But using those characters, using those animal characters, allows me to explore and to reflect on what humans are doing.
Yeah.
It allows a step back from the human world, and when you step back, you can turn and look and see what's wrong and what's right.
Mm. Speaking of which, Ciro has an absolute classic to suggest for us. Morning, Ciro.
Good morning. I selected The Animal Farm by George Orwell, and this is written about 80 years back, but feels uncannily contemporary of human society today. The whole idea that all are equal, and then somehow entitlement creeps in, and then some become more equal than others, is a serious warning. And Orwell delivers this very serious warning in a deceptively simple way, and that's what makes it an absolute genius, and I think it's a must-read across all ages.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, isn't it, Catherine? Deceptively simple, as Ciro says there. And when you're talking about trying to actually represent sometimes these very complex, very difficult human ideas to children, it's an excellent way in, isn't it, to use animals?
Right. So if you want to talk to children about power, about love, about fury, about jealousy, animals can be a spectacular way to do that. And they take you out of the intricate detail of human context. And so you can writ more large. And of course, also a brilliant source of comedy, something like Nadia Shireen's Grimwood, which is about talking foxes, is also about the chaos that children can wreak on the world. It's just told through the medium of an eagle conspiracy theorist and like a very aggressive squirrel.
You see, something like that's an immediate sell, isn't it? Nicola, we've got about 30 seconds left. Just show us one more of your books that you've bought.
Nature's Dance, all about animal societies, animals in groups. Wonderful, wonderful format. Really inviting, really exciting. I would have loved this as an eight-year-old child.
Yeah, that's fantastic, isn't it? I like the fact it's a particularly big book with a beautiful murmuration on the front
as well. And it folds out. Look, it folds out.
And it folds out. We like a fold out, don't we?
How exciting is that?
Some good ideas for half term and beyond. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Nicola Davis, the Children's Laureate for Wales. Catherine Rundle, as always, thank you. I know you've got an event at the festival as well. Thank you to our wonderful audience. There's some good suggestions there, right? Yeah.
I was carefully taking notes on the suggestions there. It's 6 minutes to nine. High drama is definitely part and parcel of the playoffs, of course, but rarely to the extent we're witnessing right at the moment. Today's championship final at Wembley should have been all about the two teams chasing a place in the Premier League. But instead, conversation has definitely been dominated by a team absent from today's action. Southampton, kicked out for spying on opponents, and stepping into the chaos, Middlesbrough. Beaten in the semi-finals, now handed a last-minute, nail-biting second chance to play Hull City. Well, I'm joined now by two big fans. Fran Griffith, who's going to Wembley for the fourth time. You're a super fan, aren't you, Fran? Good morning.
Morning. Yes, I am.
And indeed. Rob Nichols, who's travelled down to Wembley last night, in fact, and runs the longest-running football fanzine Fly Me to the Moon. Good morning to you.
Morning.
First, Fran, what does this moment mean for fans, for you?
This is huge for us. I feel like we've had a very difficult season as fans, and getting to this point, obviously at this time, you know, last week, we thought it was all over and done. It just means the world to be given this chance. And it feels like a real hit for us. You know, we could go out there, as a team and bring something back for actually, you know, it's the fan base, but there's a broader community where, Teesiders are incredibly proud of our team. We live for the weekends when Middlesbrough play. So it's a broader effect for the community and Teesiders all over the world, fans of Middlesbrough Football Club, our beloved club, and has come so unexpectedly. It just means the world to us.
And it's unexpected, right, Rob? So it must have been a last minute scramble for you to get here. What was the journey like? Did you meet lots of fans on the way?
Oh yeah, there was Borough fans all the way down the M1, and you know, with scarves out the windows, all the service stations, everyone. A lot of people came down last night, Middlesbrough fans, and they were all over London, packed out in Trafalgar Square. Lots of young fans who've never experienced what Fran and me have done before going to Wembley. So it's a really big thing. Everyone's had to mobilise incredibly quickly. I can't believe how the football club managed to get 35,000 tickets out to people in 2 days. But it's all been done so well. As Fran says, everyone is just grasping at this second opportunity.
Yeah. And Fran, what I'm wondering is, because you're based in London, did you have anyone badgering you for a place to crash?
Yeah, I've got my best friend's son, George, massive Borough fan. We had to scramble around. He's coming down, bless him, on his own. And so he was going to come and stay with me. I've had lots of friends, you know, message just to see if we can help and get them to where they need to be, particularly because the trains aren't working properly this weekend. So getting down before has been important for some fans. So, yeah, it's been a logistical nightmare, I would say.
But worth it. I'm sure everyone would say, Rob, what, I don't want to jinx it for you, but what would it mean to return to the Premier League today?
Oh, it'd be absolutely phenomenal. We could see that by, as I said, so many young kids and stuff. And it's just, we've taken so many hits as a town and as an area lately that the form of the team has just been a massive lift for everybody. And to get to the Premier League would just mean the world for so many. We're a one club town, we really do unite around the club, and it's got a real power to it. And to get to the Premier League right now would be just absolutely phenomenal, especially as we're about to celebrate our 200th anniversary as a town, and we're about to next season is our 150th as a football club. So it's really, really couldn't be better timed.
And that last minuteness about it must add to the dizziness of it. Rob Nichols, Fran Griffith, thank you very much for sharing your excitement. Anna, I think you've got quite a lot to say about this.
Well, my Middlesbrough supporting husband and son are in the car right now on the way to Wembley. So good luck to Middlesbrough. Good luck to Hull. It's worth saying, I have warmed up this wonderful audience. I'm only merely the support act, because somebody else who knows a lot about the trials and tribulations and sometimes struggles of football, the expert, in fact, Adrian Charles is here.
Yeah, I know more about the struggles than the triumphs, actually. But I've got some travel news for you. Somebody very close to me is at King's Cross Station presently, and I'm sorry to report that Hull and Middlesbrough fans are converging on King's Cross already, quite well refreshed.
Already?
Impressive.
It's not even 9 a.m.
It is impressive, but disappointing, because kick-off isn't until 3:30. I mean, it's a marathon, not a sprint, they need to remember.
You will be glad to hear that I've kept our wonderful audience solely on tea and water this morning, so they'll be extremely well-behaved.
Oh, there's free drink on Saturday Live. Come on, roll up, roll up.